go. Head on with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head on with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy. Welcome, welcome, welcome. We are live from No Fashion 2010, the Families USA Grassroots Conference, held nationally. And we're broadcasting live from the basement of the Hyatt Regency Hotel in Washington, D.C. We are just blocks away from Capitol Hill. We will have a whole slate of folks for you to hear from regarding the ongoing fight for health care. For working American families, for all Americans, as we progress through the day. Guy James is with us as well. He will be sitting down here presently. And we will get things going right away. Let me get your engineering on the fly here, so please bear with us. Okay, we've got a mic on here. Mark, if you don't mind, please just... And we'll just stop that right there. And just introduce yourself to the folks out across the Fruited Plain, if you don't mind, please.
Certainly. My name is Mark Steinberg. I'm the Deputy Director of
Health. Get up on the mic if you don't mind.
I'm sorry. My name is Mark Steinberg. I'm one of the Deputy Director of Health Policy at Families USA. And my particular focus is Medicare and issues affecting seniors.
Okay. Well, Mark, first of all, thank you very much for joining us this afternoon. Given that your specialty is Medicare issues, maybe working in reverse, there's been a lot of fear-mongering and a lot of scare tactics used by the right wing and their associated and affiliated information warriors trying to scare seniors about what health care reform would mean in this country. Nothing that I have read indicates that anything they're saying is the truth. Could you put some meat on those bones, if you don't mind?
Yeah, absolutely. I think you're absolutely right. And your first question to ask is, well, consider the source. You always have to consider the source. This is the folks who have been hostile to Medicare since it was first proposed in 1965, and it's hard to believe that they'd suddenly have a change of heart and decide that they're suddenly the best friends of Medicare and of seniors. In fact, the charges that they've made are beyond baseless. They're really quite appalling. There's no death panels in any legislation. No one in their right mind would propose such a thing. In fact, you know, there's no cuts to any guaranteed benefits in Medicare. The benefits that Medicare's always guaranteed will always be there and will continue to be there. And in fact, they would be improved under the legislation, both the House and the Senate legislation.
You mentioned there's no health, there are no death panels. I would submit to you that there are. Before your hair stands on end or anything, it seems to me that the death panels that exist in this country take place inside corporate boardrooms of healthcare insurance companies, because we have 45,000 Americans who die every year because of simple lack of access to appropriate coverage. If there are any, it's on the other side's team.
Well, I think that's absolutely right. I mean, that's where this country has had a terrible moral blot on itself for many years, and we're trying to take that away.
Let me ask about one thing that's specifically being hit hard in the at least in the media right now, and that is the so-called cuts in physician payments that are supposed to take effect. What exactly is that?
That is actually a tough, complicated issue, and it dates back many, many years. Essentially, Congress created a formula back in 1997. It was to to slow the rate of increase of physician payments, and that seemed like a good idea at the time, but it hasn't kept up with reality. And so what has happened is every year there are scheduled reductions in physician payments that are, in fact, unrealistic. And everyone agrees they're unrealistic. Even the harshest budget hawks recognize that we can't cut physician payments 20%. That's ridiculous. And so we have to go back and fix that every year. The challenge is we have to figure out how to pay for that as well. And that is something that's actually not – it was initially thought we could do it with health reform. It's been taken out in a separate track. Congress will take care of it, and they always do. In the long run, we do have to figure out a better way to pay physicians, and I think the health reform legislation takes a first stab at that by looking at ways to pay doctors to provide what's called a medical home. That's not a nursing home, but it's a medical home, meaning you have a doctor you can talk to about your problems, and your doctor gets paid to talk to you rather than simply to recommend procedures and do procedures on you.
I come from Appalachia, Mark, and we have a situation there where in a lot of small communities, you never see a doctor. You see a physician's assistant.
Mm-hmm.
And that's well and good. These are very competent, very trained professionals in their own right. But how do we – it's not the same as access to a physician. How do we remedy that kind of a situation within the framework you've described?
Well, that's a long term. There's both a short term and a long term answer. The long term is no question. We need to get more physicians and support physicians, assistants, nurses. The entire infrastructure, particularly in rural areas, does need to be built up, and that will take some time. We took a start on it with the Stimulus Act, with the Recovery Act last year, which does provide incentives for doctors to go into underserved areas. So that's a good start. I also think with health care, a lot of it is if you build it, they will come. If we have people who have insurance, which is what we're trying to accomplish with health reform, if the 45 million Americans who don't have health insurance can get it, suddenly the doctors will discover it's in their interest to go out and serve these people because there'll be patients out there who have insurance, and the doctors will be much more interested, I think, in serving these areas.
When we talk about whether it's urban or rural health care, patient education becomes a big part of it. Wellness becomes a big part of it. As a specialist in Medicare, do you see if you were operating on a perfect world basis, is the Medicare system sufficient that it could actually address the needs of all Americans as was contemplated under the old H.R. 676, Medicare for All?
In an ideal world, in a world with where we could, you know, putting politics aside, you're asking, could it work?
Yes,
I think it could work. Now, Medicare could use improvements. I think anyone who's honest about it says there's some holes in the Medicare benefit that we would love to fill, and you'd have to think hard about whether the benefit that's designed for seniors would work well for children, things like that. There are things you'd want to think through very carefully before going forward. But the basic idea could Medicare work for everyone? Sure, it could work. Politically, I think it's a tough call right now. I mean, we're having a hard enough time getting a very reasonable, moderate, in many ways written by moderate Republican piece of legislation through. But I think, yeah, you're right. Certainly, it could work with some very sensible, modest adjustments to recognize that you're trying to cover a wide variety of people. Medicare works very well for seniors. There are some things that people like me try to fix all the time, and every country in the world is always fixing their health care system. No one has it perfect.
One of the things that astonishes me most, Mark, is the two health care issues that seems to me fly under the radar, and that is vision and dental. There was a horrible story out of Maryland, a couple of years ago maybe, of the young boy who went in with a bad tooth. And it wound up costing the system $428,000 to watch him die. Are there any proposals on the table to comprehensively include vision and dental for working Americans?
That's a great question. I'd have to go back and check. I'm sad to say I don't think dental is there yet. That's going to be probably the next fight that we're the health reform will look at. I think it does include some basic vision coverage. I'm not sure that dental is in there, and I apologize for not knowing that. Unfortunately, even Medicare doesn't have great dental.
Well, that's why I was asking, because it's not there for our seniors either. Is that, in your opinion, and I'm not asking for specifics, but is that just a bureaucratic blind spot, or has the American Dental Association fallen down on the job? What?
There's It would actually be a great show for you to do one day, but what's wrong with dental care in this country? Because you're absolutely right. I knew actually one of the people who worked on that case in Maryland, and it was just an absolutely horrifying case. Part of it is the way the dental industry has evolved, that they are very much, it's not an insurance system, it's sort of a discount system. And you've got a lot of individual providers who don't really have the same kind of insurance markets even that you have for regular health care. But a lot of it is reimbursement and priorities. It's always been sort of the second class, the ugly stepchild of the healthcare system. So I think, you know, I would love nothing more than once we're done with healthcare, the big thing is to start working on some of these somewhat more tangible, some of these smaller but very, very important issues like dental care. Now, some things like the case in Maryland can be addressed by looking at reimbursement rates. I mean, the Medicaid system in Maryland, I know, was paying dentists very, very little, so it was almost impossible to find a dentist who would take Medicaid. And they've taken on that issue in Maryland, I know, because unfortunately, when you have a child die from a toothache, people even people who aren't.
But Mark, isn't that part of the problem? The fact that you've got arguably 51 different reimbursement rates through Medicaid. And you've got a dual track bureaucracy between Medicare and Medicaid. Doesn't some sort of streamlining? I mean, doesn't the situation as it stands beg for some sort of streamlining between the two?
No question. I think that people who are served by Medicare and Medicaid, who tend to be our most vulnerable, oldest and lowest income seniors in particular, get bounced between the two systems a great deal. And there's a lot of room for improvement there. And some of the legislation, pieces of legislation that is in Congress right now, are taking a close look at that. We do think we could get more better coordination. And it's a first step. It's going to go on forever.
I would suspect if there is, it's more of a Medicaid issue than a Medicare issue, but I think it also exists in Medicare. Is there an identifiable level of, and I'm really struggling for a word here, so I hope you'll forgive the one I use, bigotry with regard to these programs where the patients get, whether consciously or unconsciously, treated differently based upon what kind of coverage they present when they present at a healthcare facility?
You'll never get a physician to admit that. And I think in many cases it's not the case. There are a lot of very good, hardworking, honest doctors, hospitals who care about it. But I think it's something to be in some parts of the world that you do want to be careful about, and I think rates have a lot to do with that. I think once we get through the battle we're in right now, I think reimbursement issues are going to be important to make Medicaid and Medicare as good as anyone. Now, Medicare, you don't have the same problem, and part of it is reimbursement rates, but part of it is also just the perception of the program. People, you know, their doctors, for the most part, the vast majority of doctors take Medicare because it's how you treat seniors, by taking Medicare. Medicaid, which serves a more, you know, the very low-income populations, does have a problem. I don't think we've seen any data that actually shows Medicaid patients are treated differently, but they do have a harder time finding doctors who will see them, who will take the payments, and I think that's as much a financial issue as sort of a psychological issue.
Then, let me back up then to the rate issue that we began with. You said it's very difficult, it's a very knotty issue. Is the formula as it exists, that reimbursement formula, is it arbitrary? Is it tied to inflation? It seems like several years back we tied, and granted it took some work, but there Social Security rates were tied to inflation to take it as a political football out of the political arena. Could the same thing be done with Medicare reimbursement rates?
It could be, and I think it's in many ways a dollar issue more than anything else. It would have a cost. I mean, Congress has some control over it, and they use it. They use reimbursement rates as a way to keep finances under control. But there are proposals out there to make it more automatic, to think of new ways of rewarding value, to pay people for providing good value rather than just ordering more and more tests. I think that's something where we're going to see a lot of interest in the coming years. It's going to keep a lot of health analysts like myself busy trying to figure out what's the right way to do it. But it's not unsolvable. It's going to take some hard thinking, but I think we'll get there.
And now one last question, and it's a hard question, and I think it's probably the genesis of why the death panel myth took off. And that is that Americans, and probably human beings, don't like to talk about the end of life. But I've seen the numbers out there, and you can tell me if it's true or not, that vast amounts of system money go into care for individuals in the last 30 days of their life. And it would seem that we have to get that under control one way or another. How do we do that? Is that a function of hospice care, or is that more of an advanced directive issue? How do we deal with it?
Well, I think all of those elements can help. Certainly, advanced directives where people make their wishes clear ahead of time can be helpful. Hospice care is a way to provide very compassionate, good care for people at the end of their lives. It is a very difficult situation, and anyone, including myself, who's gone through the death of a loved one, it's easy in retrospect to say, of course, a lot of that care was probably unnecessary, but at the time, how did you know this was the end of their life?
Sure.
I think there are cases where if we have doctors who can and payment and healthcare providers who can really learn how to talk about these issues with patients and with their families and have meaningful conversations, it's a decision that families need to be able to make together. It's not a decision for the government. No one believes that it ever should be or could be. It is a decision for families to make. I think there will over time be some changes in how doctors approach this. Doctors are trained, rightfully so, to do everything they can to keep people going. And I have spoken to doctors who start thinking that, well, maybe we need to rethink our models because we can do such amazing things now, but maybe it's not always the right thing to do. But it's got to be a personal decision between the doctor and the families and the patients. And I think we'll get there.
Well, I certainly hope we will. I mean, just a full disclosure, I'm a universal healthcare guy.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like there has to be a certain contingent of us out there militating for that.
Absolutely.
In order to make whatever it is that we do get, if we do get it, more viable for more people. That having been said, can you address, and I'm not sure what the rest of your schedule looks like, so if I'm taking too much of your time, just...
I think I had a cancellation, so I have a few more minutes.
Okay, well, let me just ask you this then. Working as we do and talking as we do with an audience that is the most liberal of liberal, an audience that is the most progressive of progressive, how do you address what is perceived to be a rather profound, basically corporate welfare insurance company giveaway out of the mandate? Can you make a compelling case for it's okay, we'll make this better? How do you tell liberal America that this bill is not just going to be upward wealth transfer?
That's a good question, and it's something that we've wrestled with at times as well. I think there are a couple of things that militate against the worst of the scenario you just laid out. One issue is we do have we would have loved to have had a public option. Doesn't look like we're going to get one. But we do have what are called medical loss ratios even in the Senate bill, which is more conservative of the bills, which require insurance companies to pay out at least 85% of what they take in health in benefits. Now, 85% is tougher than a lot of companies pay out. Good ones will pay out closer to 90, 95% even, but there are some that pay out 70% and keep the rest for profits, administration, salaries, marketing.
Advertising,
absolutely. I think that's going to be a key proponent. Now, we on the progressive liberals need to stay vigilant to make sure that's enforced carefully, and they need to make sure that companies don't play games with that, because you can define a lot of things as healthcare, and in fact, they're not so healthcare. But
I saw references out there to, I guess, lobbying efforts to include prayer, and that drove me a little crazy.
Yeah, that can. So you have to be careful about that. But I think that can be a very valuable tool in making sure that taxpayers get their money's worth, and this is not something that simply goes to enrich the industry. And the other thing I think that the folks on the left absolutely have to keep in mind, this is a first step. We've got to start somewhere. And, you know, you look at something like Social Security. When it was passed in 1935, it was, by our standard, pretty weak. It left out a lot of people. It left out a lot of rural laborers who were disproportionately African-American. It left out domestic workers. And people were rightly complaining about that, saying this is not meaningful. But it was a big start, and we worked on it from there. And that's, I think, the attitude that we who have a broader vision really do want to get to, that if we have a framework, we can build on it. If we don't have the framework, you're starting at ground zero or at ground floor every time. And that's gets a little tiresome after a while.
Well, one question just leads to another, so please forgive me. But I guess I made my peace with the bill as it exists, or what it looks like we will ultimately wind up with, and I did it as a function of if one of those 45,000 that are proven to die every year in that peer-reviewed Harvard study doesn't, then we've got a bill we can live with. And that's my calculus.
I think that's a very smart and humane way to look at it. Absolutely. I mean, we know that many millions of people will have health insurance as a result of this bill, and their quality of life will be better. And if that's not what being a liberal is about, and I don't know what it is making people's lives better. Well, is it the best way to do it? Probably not, but it's not the worst way either.
No, absolutely not. Mark, I really appreciate the time you've spent with us, and perhaps at some point in the future we can do a longer conversation via the phone or something, because there are a million, and frankly, the listener, the audience would probably have a million questions that I haven't asked. That's usually the way that sort of thing works out. But I wish you the very best in this fight, and I hope that we can, whatever leverage it takes to get the, you know, I saw that remark the other day from Harry Reid that said we're not in a hurry anymore about health care. And, you know, I just stood in the corner and kicked the wall.
Yeah, I think as advocates do need to keep the sense of urgency there. And I think the president did a pretty good job last night of reminding people they've got to get this done. And that's the message that's coming out of our conference here, is that our work is not done. We will finish it. There is a way to get it done, and we will. It'll take a few weeks of negotiations, hammering out the details, but I am more optimistic this week than I was last week that we're going to get it done. So
then I will add a quantum of optimism to mine, based because you're far closer to the process than I am, and if you see some reason to hope, I'll hang on to that.
Now, it won't happen if people don't call, if people don't take action. I mean, they need to keep the pressure on.
Yeah, this can't be a passive process.
Right. And even if you're holding your nose, sometimes you got to do it. You got to say this is going to save lives, and it's something we absolutely need to have happen. And it's a message to the liberals and the moderates out there that need to hear.
All right. Thank you, Mark Steinberg.
Thank you, Bob. I really appreciate
your time.
It was
a pleasure making your acquaintance.
It's been a pleasure as well.
Take
Thanks
care.
So much for coming to Washington.
Oh, my pleasure, indeed. Bye now. And that was Mark Steinberg. He is the Deputy Director of Healthcare Policy, focusing on Medicare issues for Families USA, the organizing entity behind this conference and behind this Radio Row. We are about to be joined by human rights advocate and attorney Bob Amsterdam. He is with us this afternoon, and we're awfully glad he could be here. Bob, we've talked before. Thank you for popping by.
Pleasure.
Appreciate it. I trust you're having a good day, and quite a crowd we have here. Let me ask you off the bat: is there a nexus between how America treats issues relating to health care and how America addresses issues of human rights?
Yes, I honestly believe that a society that doesn't take care of itself has a very difficult time understanding the need to take care of others. And as someone who, as a young man, lived in a terrible situation where my father had a heart attack and my credit cards were up to their limit and we were denied access at one point in a critical situation, I can only tell you that I think that the brutality of health care in this country, when you are indigent or when you're just not covered for one reason or another, is something that a foreigner has a very difficult time understanding. So I think it does have ramifications, and I think that, unfortunately, this administration has been, on the human rights issue, one of the most dilatory and opportunistic on human rights that I've ever come across. It's an area of real disappointment.
I hate to say, it grieves me to say, Bob, that I couldn't agree more, but I couldn't agree more. Issues relating to China policy, and frankly, even though so many efforts relating to Haiti have been absolutely heroic, by the same token, you wonder, and you know, maybe that's the rap on the entire first year of the Obama administration. Do these guys get it?
Well, you know, let me tell you something. I've just reached the conclusion that they don't when it comes to foreign policy and human rights. I'll tell you, I'm going to be speaking in an event on Russia on Tuesday. And I still have a client. As you know, I was arrested in the middle of the night and thrown out of the country. But we still have a man facing his second set of bogus charges there. In the last year, we've had a series of lawyers and journalists murdered, including the man who helped my blog in Russia, a lawyer who was shot and had his brains blown out in February of last year. And we have a government that is just incredibly naive, believing that we need to instrumentalize the Russian people so somehow we'll have a deal with Iran, when China has been absolutely unreachable in trying to gain any sort of leverage on either the Iranians, or for that matter, they've been of no help in trying to calm down Chavez in Venezuela.
Have we, because this is how it seems to me, Bob, have we utterly abandoned the human rights high ground in terms of attempting to leverage China in exchange for some sort of obsequious role relating to the degree of economic leverage that they have over us? The recent Google debacle comes to mind.
Well, I think that we cede the high ground as long as we don't address and confront them not only on human rights but on trade, on currency, on a whole gamut of issues. We have a $2 trillion trade deficit. They are absolutely working the world on a currency scam that's shocking. And no one has the courage to step up to the plate and say American companies simply can't compete with an artificially deflated Chinese currency. I do not understand it. We have a level of intellectual property piracy going on in that country, the likes of which we've never seen before. Again, muted responses from Washington.
And you know, what I'm hearing from you, Bob, is something that I've heard from the labor community as well. That we're never going to be able to compete with China based on the sort of the blue smoke and mirrors approach that they take to their currency valuation. You know, from the human rights community to the labor community, and yet you would think that these are topics and that there are interest groups associated with them that would have the Obama administration's ear. Why is that not the case?
Listen, I see it on the Russia stuff, where I have seen the most ill-informed activity going on. I can't answer the question. One of the things I'll tell you is China and its leadership are incredibly stressed. They're in incredible trouble. The possibility that they're in the middle or about to go into one of the biggest bubbles the world has ever seen exists. And the fact of the matter is that we're not helping China. We're complicit in China's problems because we're not addressing the fact that that is an economy that has to systemically take jobs away from the rest of the world in order to employ the tens of millions who are coming in to the cities from the countryside. And the leadership is hostage to that movement. The leadership in China simply is hostage to their own insecurity over their own legitimacy internally.
You know, it's interesting you mention Russia as well, though. I live in Appalachia. I live in West Virginia. I am an activist within the community that is trying to end mountaintop removal there. I don't know if you're familiar with the practice or the process. But one of the things that struck us with manifest horror in the last year was when we found out that a significant amount of coal reserves that would require the blowing up of more mountains had been sold to a Russian conglomerate. Is there no little box that we have to tick in American commerce or in American government anymore that says that that somebody is or is not worth doing business with, is or is not?
Well, I don't know the name of that company, and Russian companies can be as good as any other foreign company. There is, on the security side, legislation called CFIUS, which deals with security issues. I have no idea if these are strategic reserves or what they are. But, obviously, quite frankly, some of the Russian companies outside of Russia behave as great corporate citizens, and it may be worth approaching the head office in Russia as opposed to just working through people in the U.S. who probably don't have a lot of authority.
Or and it's possible that the home office may not know what they're buying vis-a-vis what's going to be required to extract it.
Very, very possible.
Which brings me to another topic, Bob, and that is that the recent Citizens United decision out of the Supreme Court,
mm-hmm.
Which, frankly, I think, and disagree with me if you wish, or will, has, from the standpoint of our political process in this country, as many negative ramifications as Plessy had in race relations in this country in terms of what it gives away to corporations to, and it opens the door, doesn't it, for undue influence in the political process. But as long as a foreign entity has an American corporate home, some sort of American chartered corporation, they can run their money into the system, can they not? Whether it be China, whether it be Venezuela with Citgo, whether it be
you have FARA, you have a certain level of reporting to the extent that government and that kind of lobbying is involved, and that can actually include media. So I think we all have to pay attention to that. I think, quite frankly, I have a problem with too many restrictions on political speech. So I fall between this and the earlier McCullough decision. But I will say I certainly disagreed with the president attacking the Supreme Court last night in the middle of his State of the Union address. And I think that, it is always possible to re-legislate those issues and come to a compromise that makes sense. But let's be really clear. This administration is absolutely as cozy and comfortable with lobbyists as the prior administration. That's the problem with the health care issue.
You mean the big pharma meeting that sort of set the tone for the...
Absolutely. I mean, that's the tragedy of what we're dealing with.
Well, it's going to be a fascinating year to watch all of this shake out. If you had a wish list of druthers, how would you change the direction or the tone of administration policies on these issues that are so much a part of your daily life?
Look, we have to understand that Andrei Sakharov 50 years ago was right when he said how a country treats its citizens determines how it behaves in the international community. Our brothers in China and Russia who are jailed, who are beaten or who are murdered are our responsibility. Just like my client in Singapore who has just spent a week shackled because he dared to march, and I mean peacefully march, in a small group against an autocratic regime.
He's been on my show.
Yes, I know. Thank you. It's shocking what we let, quote, our allies, unquote, get away with. And I would love to see the American vision of Kennedy, or gosh, for that matter, Jimmy Carter, who we all look on with some disdain in terms of his administration, at least had the courage to put human rights as an issue, which this administration backs away from. Barack Obama taking a page from Henry Kissinger is just not what I was hoping for.
You know, it's hard to even let that get through your skull.
I know. I know.
And you know, you mentioned Singapore, and what you said about and I've read Mr. Sakharov's quote in the past, and what that does, makes me think about is the fact that the United States has fully, you know, 1% of its population doing hard time. And if what Mr. Sakharov said is true, then we've got a moat in our own eye that needs to be plucked before, and maybe that's what compromises us being able to address human rights with other countries, is the fact that we have become so hard on our own people.
Let me tell you, I think that it is worse to be arrested and put in the system here than in almost any civilized country in the world today. It is frightening the way the law works and the length of time people are given custodial sentences and the mandatory sentencing guidelines. I find this shocking and appalling, frankly. I mean,
we're warehousing human beings at this point, are we not?
Absolutely. And I'll tell you, as someone who's fortunate enough to have a foot in both Canada and the United States, there are many crimes that in Canada would receive 1/8 the time received in the United States. 1/8. And they're complaining about overcrowding. It's really a tremendous issue for review, because it's also gender, class, race bias that needs to be addressed. I mean, look at the percentage of our young black youth that are incarcerated.
You know, I'm watching my chat room here, Bob, and one of the folks in the chat room right now is listening live from Sweden, and he says that most Swedes I know say they've lost all interest in ever visiting the USA because the U.S. Among other civilized countries is being seen as a fast approaching a rogue state.
Well, you know, I have to say I spend a lot of time in Sweden, and I would agree shockingly with that, in the sense that I know for many people I live with in England, I'm based in London, they have now decided to not come to the United States because of the whole issue of the procedures when they arrive here, the feeling that they're not wanted, the feeling that the United States is not the country they grew up wanting to see. And as somebody with you know, a Bronx background buried deep in there, I find it pretty hard to believe this level of antipathy. And I thought when Obama came in, we'd have a real chance at change. I'll tell you, the amount of executive privilege he's maintained would shock your conscience if we got to talk about it. Guantanamo is still there. We've got targeted killings occurring at a rate that is vastly disproportionate to what many perceive as the risk in some of these areas. We're on autopilot on a bunch of issues that are incredibly sensitive. I represent one of the key leaders of the Muslim community in Nigeria, and he and I have been trying to work to at least give a voice to the tens of millions of Muslims in Nigeria who feel completely abandoned by a president who, after the terrorist father goes and hands him to the U.S. authorities, then has the government of the United States essentially attack Nigeria and place Nigerians in discriminatory procedures when their citizenry did everything right. They actually reported it to the U.S. authorities. If we're going to be detaining people, let's detain the SOBs who didn't put the information together and who risked all those lives.
How do you walk up to, and you fly internationally much more than I, well, anybody does, more than I do. But how do you walk up to the ticket counter and say, the guy's from Somalia, they don't do passports in Somalia, you know, we do this all the time, let him on the plane. How does that happen?
Look,
in the Netherlands?
I went after the wrong community, because he clearly wasn't properly searched.
Well, without a doubt, and just the idea of no passport, no problem.
Incredible.
Astonishing. Thank you very kindly. I really appreciate you coming by, and always enjoy our conversations.
As do I. Thank you so much.
You have a website. Where can folks go?
www.robertamsterdam.com.
Wonderful.
Thank you.
Thank you very kindly. All right, we are up running, and things are going considerably better than they got started. Guy James also behind the microphone with me, my intrepid broadcast colleague, largely responsible for the fact that I'm in here as well. Guy, it was a little. Then again, I guess this is our. It was a little hairy getting started, but we're rolling.
Oh yeah, yeah, we're rolling. It was a little difficult. You know, interesting watching you through all that.
Oh no.
Yeah, it was. It was very interesting watching you. Of course, those of you at home, you don't know, Bob is a massive last-minute preparation for something like this. And I had confidence that when he got this table here with about 15 minutes to go until the time, that Bob would just go bing, bang, boom, and we would be on. Well, the best laid plans, as they say.
Bang after glee. But it was, yeah, it was largely a function of no internet. Yeah. You know, it's a hard, it's a difficult thing to run an internet radio network with internet.
It is.
Although I did go on New Jersey Avenue and scream a little bit, but
I didn't follow you out there. It's cold. I didn't want to go.
Oh no, it's nice there.
Is it?
You've been.
I know why
long.
You went out there.
You don't know from cold.
Well, we had cold in Florida not too long ago.
Did it drop to 60?
Oh no, it got down to 36 in Fort Myers.
15 minutes or so?
Yeah.
Long enough to remind people that they own a.
Not three's the maters.
Oh, well, those aren't tomatoes down there.
No, they're not. They're just green things.
And just to let and Guy's never seen before, so let me just send a message out to ELO. Guy needs to see a photograph of the Hornet DC field loss. and to let you know, yeah, we did do that last night. And we had a delightful time. And we plotted out what we would get done. It was a business thing.
Yes, of course.
Entirely.
Yes, and we discussed business.
We absolutely did.
Some kind of business, sure.
Here it comes. Here it comes. And by the way, if you're listening live, don't hesitate to pop into the chat room. And just a little reminder, all of this will rerun in the Horns regular slot after we're done today. And loop through. And by the way, greetings and hallucinations to everybody tuning in after the Mike Malloy show tonight. You know, the having the truth seekers on board is a wonderful it's a wonderful addition to the Horn family, and it means a lot. So you know, we'll be here live at noon again tomorrow, which is Friday. See, it's all running together for me now, Guy.
Oh, see the picture. We had an interesting experience on.
Oh yes, we did. Yeah, absolutely, we did. Absolutely.
Yeah, we stood at this very corner here last night and watched the presidential motorcade go by.
Don't get past the pole. Don't step past the pole. I have told you twice. If you want to be here, you get back behind that pole.
That's what the police were telling us, as if Bob and I were posing a huge threat
to national security.
Yes.
But I got to tell you, as much. And this isn't a partisan political issue. It is embarrassing to see the royal treatment that a simple drive from 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue to the Capitol of the United States requires.
Oh yeah.
Anybody who's ever seen, like, for instance, one of the second generation Star Wars movies where they're on whatever the home planet is for Princess Bobblyhead or whatever the Natalie Portman character. Where there's all these things zipping around in the air over the city. It was like that last night.
Oh yes.
The sky over Washington D.C. was abuzz with every rotary winged aircraft I think available for 100 miles.
Absolutely. It's amazing. I'd like to know how much that 2 mile drive from the White House to the. It's not even quite 2 miles. I'd like to know how much that cost.
Yeah, and they said it was done in 2 minutes.
Yeah.
And it's limousines, it is and cop cars and Secret Service and FBI.
46 motorcycles.
Yeah, and then what can only be a mobile surgical suite. I mean, this is beyond any sort of ordinary ambulance.
Here comes your next guest, Bob.
Yes, indeed. Let's bring her on. Yes. Wonderful, wonderful. Jennifer Sullivan is here with us now. And Jennifer, let me get your mic hot. Go ahead and put your headphones on if you want to be able to hear yourself.
Sure.
And Jennifer Sullivan, Brian called you Jenny. Is Jenny okay?
Jenny's great.
I'm Bob.
Hi, Bob.
Very pleased to meet you and to have a conversation with you this afternoon. You are a senior health policy analyst with, again, the organizing group behind this meeting today, Families USA. And you specialize in CHIP and
Medicaid.
Mm-hmm. So we talked with Mark Steinberg a few minutes ago, and he's the Medicare guy.
Indeed.
And you are the your emphasis is on the Medicaid and CHIP end of things. And we touched on some issues with Mark that speak more to Medicaid and CHIP. As a departure point, the young man who a couple of years or so ago in Maryland passed away after nothing short of a nightmare that began with a bad tooth.
Right.
I guess as a starting place for our conversation, as we contemplate some level of health care reform, and I would like more rather than less, myself being a liberal progressive, do you think the legislation now under contemplation does a sufficient amount or enough to make stories like that less likely?
It absolutely will, and hopefully, like you said, we are going to be passing something in the next coming weeks and months. But absolutely, by expanding Medicaid, we are going to be adding millions of people to the rolls and getting people benefits that they haven't gotten before. And in a crucial part of that, that is something I've been working on and paying attention to, and families has definitely been paying attention to, is the enrollment piece of things. Because as you mentioned in the Diamante Driver case, having a Medicaid card is not enough. Just because you are eligible for coverage or even enrolled in coverage doesn't necessarily mean that you have access to the services and you're getting to see the providers that you need to see to stay healthy and avoid anything like that tragedy several years ago. The opportunity that we have in health reform is that in creating a new system for subsidized coverage through the so-called exchange, we will be bringing a lot of people in and hopefully raising consciousness that there are programs available to people, and that provides us an opportunity to really streamline enrollment and bring some of the legacy Medicaid enrollment systems up to speed. It gives us an opportunity to really update those systems, put new money into them, and streamline them with this new subsidy program.
With that being the case, let's try to talk a couple of numbers, if we could, please. In terms of getting insurance to some of that 47 million number who are uninsured in this country today, what percentage of that 47 million who get coverage will be getting coverage through Medicaid and or CHIP?
The Congressional Budget Office has estimated that the health reform bill will cover approximately 15 million new people in Medicaid who currently are not enrolled in the program. So we will see huge leaps in coverage and huge leaps in the rolls, which is going to have a big effect on states who run those programs. There's going to need to be more people on the ground to administer them, to make sure that people have the assistance they need, both to get into the program and then to use the program to get services.
One of the most brutal phrases in government, as far as I'm concerned, where money's concerned, are the two dreaded words, unfunded mandate. To what degree, if this legislation does get through, and sooner rather than later, hopefully, are you confident that it is and will be fully funded?
You know, the remarkable thing about the Medicaid expansion is that for as much attention as has been given to the special deals that were made, particularly for Nebraska, the Medicaid expansion is fully federally funded, every penny of that coverage, unlike the current system and the current matching system in which the states and the federal government share the cost of coverage. The lowest match is 50%, and it goes up from there. The expansion coverage, any expansion populations, are going to get full federal funding for three entire years. So that is the federal government coming in, taking responsibility, and making sure that the program has the funds it needs to expand without any burden on states.
What happens in year four?
There is a significant increase in the federal match for those expansion populations. So the trade-off is that states need to keep doing whatever they're doing now. And if you are in California or New York or Pennsylvania, that's a little different than if you are in Alabama or Mississippi or Utah. But states are going to have to maintain whatever effort they've been putting forward so far, so they're not on the hook to put more into that. But the corresponding thing is that the federal government is going to be paying for a lot more of the new individuals that enroll.
Okay. And of course, we saw the SCHIP expansion of children's coverage. Is that also addressed within this legislation, or a further expansion, or a broadening of the eligibility parameters?
Right. Children's coverage is something that was definitely has been pretty hotly contested in health reform, precisely because we reauthorized the program about a year ago now, shortly after the president entered office, and there's great concern that we not lose the gains we've already made. The program was reauthorized last year with many, many things that are strengthening the program, making enrollment easier, making more children eligible, and making sure that the funding is there to make that happen. And what the Senate bill does that we believe will probably be maintained is that the CHIP program will be continued. It will be, right now it's authorized through 2013. It will continue for an additional two years, under the current funding mechanism, and then the years after that, while it will need to be reauthorized, and that will be another fight for progressives to take up, and actually the program has bipartisan support, so I think that it will be popular to reauthorize even at that point, but there is a promise in this bill of more federal support for the program, a higher matching rate, actually some 20-odd percentage point increase in that matching rate for every state.
So then, where do you cut down or come down? Is what is contemplated? Is it acceptable to you? Is it broad enough to you? What would make it better?
What's in the bill now is a really strong beginning, and I think that although it's really easy to pick out the things that we would like to change, we would like to see Medicaid available higher than 133%. But a year ago, if you had told me we were going to expand Medicaid to everyone and every state would have to do it to a certain minimum percentage of poverty, I would have been shocked, even knowing the results of the 2008 elections. I still would have been shocked. I mean, this is remarkable. We have a system that's built on, the categories are built on Elizabethan poor laws, and we're going to bring that into the 21st century once and for all and say, if you are poor,
wow,
you are going to get covered.
That's, well, in that analysis, it is profound, then. I don't like doing fluff questions. I want real content out there for the folks who are sharing their time with us. What is left to be done past this bill? Do you see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
Where does it need to go? What is left absent? What is wanting in this bill still?
Where there's going to be a lot of work to be done, regardless of how the bill eventually looks, is making sure that access is there. That once people are getting the card, they're getting the subsidy, they're getting Medicaid, number one, that they can get into the program seamlessly, and that's going to take a lot of hard work on the part of advocates and state administrators, as well as federal administrators, but that once people do get in the door, that that's an easy process, and then getting to the doctor is an easier process.
For people who are on Medicaid, and I think this is, I haven't heard a lot of discussion on this topic, but I think it is significant. For people who are on Medicaid and perhaps can transition away to, you know, maybe they get a better job that has coverage, something like that. Are there provisions inside the bill that make sure that a person transitioning from, say, Medicaid coverage to a for-profit, profit-driven coverage, that for-profit insurance company cannot hold diagnoses that were made while they were on Medicaid against them, vis-a-vis pre-existing conditions, that kind of thing?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's one of the cornerstones of this entire reform, is bringing the private market, whether that's through the exchange or elsewhere. Anywhere any individual is buying private insurance, they're not going to be denied coverage because of pre-existing conditions, and certain conditions are not going to be carved out of their coverage.
And you know, there's been a lot of talk about, well, you know, we're going to eliminate pre-existing conditions. If on the one hand we eliminate pre-existing conditions by saying, you know, thou shalt not know more, but by the same token, they can the private insurance companies can say, well, okay, we're going to cover pre-existing conditions, but at this exorbitant rate. Mm-hmm. Is there some sort of safeguard within the legislation for that sort of conduct?
There absolutely is within the subsidy section, which is what I'm an expert on. Unfortunately, you'd have to talk to one of my colleagues that focuses more on the private market to talk about some of those protections outside of the world of the exchange and subsidies. But within that world, it's a sliding scale based on income, essentially. And Congress still has to make some key decisions. I understand those decisions are underway as to exactly what those so-called affordability provisions will look like, but it will be based on your income. A certain percentage of your income, that is the limit as to what you can pay, and that's also tied to the subsidy that you will receive from the government.
What kind of overall cost controls are there as far as what Medicaid itself is pays? Are there hard limits for lifetime within the exchanges or Medicaid? Are there hard limits for lifetime that we've seen, such as exist inside private insurance?
Not exactly, no. How the Medicaid benefit package is structured, particularly for the new individuals that are going to gain that coverage, has yet to be seen. And there's going to be a lot of debate, I suspect, on how states are going to do that. Medicaid will remain under the purview primarily of states to design the programs and figure out which plans are available to participate and what those benefits look like. But at a minimum, those benefits will be linked to the minimum benefits available through the exchange, so that at least folks, low-income folks, are guaranteed a minimum benefits package. Now, as a Medicaid advocate, we would hope that whatever benefits the state is giving to these new people in Medicaid look a lot like what the other people were getting and are getting today in Medicaid, which is generally fairly robust, although states are clearly starting to cut and have been cutting a lot over the last couple of years.
How much hoop jumping is involved in terms of getting necessary tests and necessary procedures? Those are all managed. Those are all individual hoops maintained by the states as well, aren't they?
Certainly. Some Medicaid services are delivered on a fee-for-service basis. In other states, you've got quite a bit of managed care going on in Medicaid, and so it's going to depend on the individual plan as to what hoops you have to jump through.
In your best of all possible world scenario, would we be are we better off with 50, 51, 53, however many individual Medicaid systems, or would it be better to have a single system that is managing things on a on some sort of a consistent basis for all Americans? If you had your choice, which way would you go?
Having looked at the way CHIP developed over the past decade or so, although it would have been nice if it had been a Medicaid expansion and something that states didn't have quite as much flexibility as they end up having, because by virtue of the fact that states had the flexibility and had the ability to buy into the program and create a program unique for people in Utah, unique for people in Mississippi, they bought into it more. And so I think to the extent that we want to make these programs successful and have something that people take pride in and that we remove the stigma, some of the state flexibility is an important piece of the buy-in. That comes along with the responsibility on the part of the federal government within HHS, the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, to really make sure those programs run well and that they're issuing the regulations that need to happen.
Isn't the other side of that, though, that some states that that have governments that are ab initio hostile to the process, to the principle itself behind Medicaid, thereby make it more difficult to access it? I mean, and you mentioned Mississippi. You've got to, I mean,
it doesn't get harder than Mississippi.
You can't own two pennies to rub together in Mississippi and qualify for Medicaid. And I would submit to you that is deliberately done.
Right. Right.
Is there anything as it stands within the legislation that would, and maybe it's the fact that you're talking about this 3 years of fully funding, that would make hostile state governments more likely to extend coverage to their low and no income populations?
Well, we're going to have a situation where states aren't going to have a choice. They're going to have to expand Medicaid to these new people. We're going to have to work hard to make sure that the benefits and the procedures are in place to make it work better. But there are things implicit in the law, like no more asset tests, for example. That's one hoop that a lot of low-income families have to jump through right now.
Wow.
And that's being eliminated entirely. No more asset tests in Medicaid, save for a few small populations within the disability and senior community by virtue of their eligibility for other programs that require that. But
because families that desperately need it can be excluded for the ownership of a
car.
Rusty old vehicle.
Right, right.
Home ownership, which the rest of our society seems to put a premium on, is a bar to Medicaid health care, I would say, in most jurisdictions, if not all.
Right.
You're telling me that goes by the board?
That goes by the board. That's no longer...
And when we say by the board, is that also across the board?
It is. It is. Asset tests would no longer be permitted for determining eligibility for Medicaid.
God, that's almost like getting rid of the literacy test in voting in the South.
It's a big deal. It's not talked about, and frankly, the less we talk about it in the heated political environment we're in, the happier I am. These things have been in the provisions of the bill all along, in the various committee bills, and the bills that have gone through Congress. And the less we talk about them, the happier I am, because they're not vulnerable.
Well, don't worry. We're talking. you're among friendlies here.
This is a
liberal and progressive audience. But and not to disagree with you, but I would think that you would leverage. You might energize a lot more people to advocate for it in Alabama Stan and Mississippi Stan.
Mm-hmm.
If they knew that was what it meant for them.
Right.
But I can understand why in the charged atmosphere of the Hill, maybe not so much.
There are certain members that love to talk about public programs and how they don't work, but that's absolutely something we're very excited about.
Well, as well you should be. Is there anything in
the legislation as it stands that you simply don't like?
I've been focusing on the Medicaid expansion and the children's expansions, and I'm really happy with where those are going. And I think you probably heard this before, but advocates are looking at this as an opportunity to start reforming healthcare, not the end note. This is the opportunity to get in there and really improve these systems. So this is the beginning, not the end.
So if the thing were to, if it were to pass and be signed by the president, do you see your role as immediate? Okay, then. You've got a next layer of advocacy to engage?
Absolutely. We've already started to think about what things need to happen in the states to implement effectively.
You want to give me a hint?
We have started to think about what resources are going to need to be leveraged to make enrollment happen. Not just the outreach, the being at grocery stores and being at clinics and making sure people know about the program, but making sure that the decision makers at the state level are aware of the changes that need to be made and are getting familiar with each other and with the new opportunities that are going to be available to them to break down some of those legacy systems, to simplify, to connect programs that are means-tested, et cetera.
Okay. Jennifer Sullivan, thank you very kindly. It's been a lovely conversation.
Thanks very much, likewise.
And if you've got information that needs to get out to the liberal community, I hope you will not hesitate to give us a shout.
All right.
And thank you for the hard work, and thank you organizationally for everything that you all have made happen here today.
Oh, thank you very much.
And thank you for having us.
Okay, bye-bye.
Have a great day.
You too.
Jennifer Sullivan, senior policy analyst for Families USA. She works particularly, as you heard, inside issues relating to CHIP and Medicaid. I did not know that. And did you know this guy? Did you know that means testing, asset testing, or asset testing goes away inside this health care reform bill? That owning a rusted out old car is no longer going to be preclusive of having access to Medicaid?
Really?
I kid you not. And that,
my rusted out old car?
My rusty red truck.
No.
Rusty dented.
Dented
red truck. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Hi. Oh, wonderful. Hi, I'm Bob Kincaid. Do please have a seat, and we'll hot up the mic, and we'll get going. We're about to be joined by Carolyn Wadhams from the Center for American Progress. I worship at your shrine. thinkprogress.org is one of my go-to sites for show prep every night, and we really appreciate you being here.
Thanks.
Yeah, you try that again, guy.
I said it's my home page.
Yeah, can't live without it. Can't live without it. I would say that without a doubt, it is probably the best thing that has ever happened to those of us who work in this industry doing liberal talk.
Great. I'd love to hear that.
Thank you.
You
know, tell the gang back home we said.
I will.
Big golf clap.
I will.
We're really glad to have you here today. Tell me what. And I know because I follow the website so closely that it looked like there was a significant internal policy debate about what the position would be with regard to the health care bill, especially after Dr. Dean made the statements that he made. You guys decided to come down on the advocate for passage direction. Can you tell us a little bit about how that came to be?
Well, sure. I mean, just to state up front, I am not a healthcare expert. I work on national security at the
Neither
Center.
Neither am I. I don't play one for the on the radio either.
So I don't follow it very closely, but I can tell you that I think our healthcare team basically decided that anything is better than the status quo, and the bill was definitely better than the status quo, and there were changes that were made that responded to the desires of the American people, so that it's better to do that than to do nothing. But clearly, they don't think it's perfect.
Mainly because it isn't.
Right. But, I mean, and President Obama recognized that last night in the State of the Union, but it does answer some of the concerns. So you move forward with you can't make the perfect enemy the good or whatever.
Sure,
so
sure.
That's basically, I think, the bottom line on it.
You know, with everything from Mic Check Radio, the Mic Check Radio project over there, just to the daily postings of Think Progress. You guys do a great job also of making very accessible the concept of opposition research, I suppose, would be that, and keeping up what the lunatics who have gotten loose from the asylum are doing from the right wing. What is there a sense of how we deal with the obstructionism that's coming from the lunatic right now at your organization? Is it full frontal? Is it jujitsu? Is it subtle? Do we need to be subtle? Do we need to be in their face? As far as, and not just remedies to issues of relating to health care, but relating to everything that the Republican Party is keeping from happening in this country.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty shocking. And I mean, I think there's a little bit of frustration because President Obama really is, I mean, and, you know, he's trying to reach out in this constructive way to the other side, and it's just not working because they're not coming back with anything. All they want to do is just make sure his agenda doesn't go through.
Well, we've remarked on the show on a number of occasions that the problem with reaching out to the other side is that by virtue of the nature of the other side, when you extend the olive branch, we tend to draw back a bloody stump.
Right. I mean, there's nothing constructive that's going on by doing that. I mean, I think that the one of the things that people are trying to do at the center is just dispel the myths and document what. Make sure that, you know, if you just get one side, which is how our radio has, it's been dominated by the conservative talk, if you just have that, then the American public can't even decipher what is spin and what is reality. And so there's, I think one of the things that we're trying to do with Think Progress and others is just get the other side out and show where they're actually lying. where the conservative argument is actually not true. And you know, I see it especially with issues like with national security. The way that conservatives have said, you know, why is Obama? Why are we paying to protect terrorists rather than to defeat terrorists? And they're, you know, with the whole Guantanamo Bay and with trying this, the guy Abdul Matulab who tried to blow up the plane, you know, they're bringing him before a federal court.
Sure.
Which is what the Bush administration did, but the spin around it is actually deceitful.
And I guess, Carolyn, the question is, and this is something that occupies so very much of our time, how do you defeat that spin when for every single consider the hour of broadcasting that we're doing right now from 1 p.m. to 2 p.m., okay? That's 1 hour of liberal broadcasting.
Yeah.
In this country, for that same 1 hour of liberal broadcasting, there are 1,000 hours. And it was some folks from the Center for American Progress that first identified this, I believe.
Right.
That there are 1,000 hours of right-wing hate. Is there something more we need to be doing, or I mean
because I think it's just more investment in progressive radio and more investment in progressive television, more counteraction to what's going on. I mean, I think I think that it's starting. I mean, I think there's definitely voices, and hopefully it will continue to grow. But clearly, for a long time, the conservatives intentionally were investing in this.
Yes.
And we were not. And that is now hopefully changing. But it's what's upsetting now is that you have a feeling that people, especially on the left, are becoming increasingly disillusioned, again, with President Obama, with the Dems, with what's going on in there, and so there's the despondency or disillusionment is turning into just inaction, passivity, and I worry about sort of what that means in terms of people mobilizing, because clearly we have to be doing a lot more to push back on the left, and I just hope that people feel energy. I mean, the 2008 election was an indication of how mobilized the left was, but it's got to continue.
But that mobilization is, it seems like it burns off like morning fog, Carolyn, because look at what happened in Virginia. You've got a Democratic candidate for governor who is running as fast as he can to get away from Barack Obama. And he gets his butt handed to him.
Yeah.
And yet still the message arising out of that is that, well, my God, you know, there's a Republican resurgence in America. No. You know, the guy was not being the Democrats wanted to elect. You know, the polling data out of Massachusetts, well, the election in Massachusetts has set the entire Congress on its ear, and yet the polling data is there saying this was not a rejection of Democrats.
Sure,
this
and it was, wasn't a rejection of health care,
and
it wasn't a rejection of Obama's
of
national security or anything.
It was, you know, and this happens in politics, it happens in football games, it happens in baseball, basketball, hockey. It was a game poorly played.
Right.
And those things are going to happen, and yet the message machine, the right wing, is out there saying, well, you know, clearly America loves Republicans and God and apple pie. And you know, we struggle to counter it. You know, Guy has been to a lot more of these radio rows than I have, but I've been to a few now. And I cannot help but note the absence of a sign here today. There is no one here from something called Air America.
Right.
Air America shuttered. It shut down. It shut down its website. It hung its listeners out to dry. And it's unconscionable. But it was also because 6 multinational corporations own a vast majority of the radio stations in this country, and because it was impossible to get their terrestrial programs placed on enough radio stations to make it viable. You know, we operate only on the internet, and we do that because, frankly, it's not worth fooling with terrestrial radio right now.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I don't know the backstory in Air America, except that I understand that they've gone belly up. But you'd think now there would be such a need for that voice, and I just don't get why why it couldn't survive. I mean, and that's the thing. What's interesting is that, you know, especially with something like Think Progress, there was a sense of, well, what are they going to do? This is the progressive blog at the Center for American Progress. What are they going to do once President Obama goes in? Because, you know, then what's the point? But the truth is that there's actually more. They have more relevance than they've ever had.
Absolutely, and there's more content.
There's more content, and there's also, I mean, there is a machine on the other side that's really pushing back and distorting what's happening, and it's absolutely essential that they continue just putting out there the facts. And and you know, I see it a lot with the national security. I mean, just all the lunacy about national security, and especially, I mean, I'm a little bit concerned also with right now. I mean, the Dems are saying, no, we're going to cap our domestic spending, but not our military spending. We can continue to increase our military spending, but not, we're going to cap our education. Da, da, da. And that, you know, I think the progressive voice needs to say, wait a second. Why do we continue to think it's okay to increase our defense budgets and our national security budget and cap everything else? The left is so worried about being seen as weak on national security,
sure,
that we can, and it's because there's not enough. The politicians feel vulnerable on the issue, and there's got to be more people on the left who are speaking out about this and giving them cover.
Mm-hmm.
To be more bold on some of these issues.
But you know, you identified something a moment ago, Carolyn, that is so true, and that is when you said that the right wing deliberately invests.
Yes, that is true.
In the broadcast message machine, and I've tried to point this out to our audience on a number of occasions. If you listen to any given right wing radio show. And, you know, the folks over at Media Matters have interns whose ears must bleed at the end of the day because they have to spend, you know, 3 hours with Glenn Beck or Rush Limbaugh.
Right, right.
I mean, there's no drug good enough to make that go away when you go home. But they document this stuff. And if you sit and you listen to these shows and you listen to the ads that run in them, now, I'm not an economist, just like you're not a healthcare policy person. I'm not an economist. But I can tell you that if you listen to the national availabilities for the ads that run in there, for vacuum cleaners that pick up bowling balls, Swedish mattresses, and herbal baldness remedies, there is no way that if everybody listening to that program bought that product, there is no way that there is still enough profit out of that to provide a huge profit base to premier radio networks, and then in turn also provide enough profit to pay Rush Limbaugh $40 million a year, to pay Sean Hannity,
right,
to pay Glenn Beck.
Right.
It's a dodge, okay? I mean, and it just is. And that's because there are right-wing outfits that very quietly make sure that all of this is underwritten, and never ask anything for it, simply knowing that the message being out there is the job that they want done in the first place.
Sure.
And I would submit to you that our side hasn't figured.
Yes.
Know, some of us have, but a big portion of the folks who have control, of those kind of budgetary choices, have not figured it out.
Yeah, and I think that's what the president of the Center for American Progress intentionally decided to do about 6 years ago. This is John Podesta.
Right.
He basically saw the landscape, saw how conservatives have been investing in think tanks, generating ideas. He saw how they were investing in media. And he thought, wait a second, there's a complete void on the left. I'm going to start building something. And it's, you know, it's basically the Center for American Progress as a progressive think tank is sort of one of the only think tanks, at least out there, and then, you know, but there are other blogs are built. Blogs,
right,
on the left,
right,
are building and everything. But it's true. There hasn't been fair competition about the ideas. And President Bush utilized those conservative think tanks, especially very, very well.
Oh,
he,
yeah,
brought in those guys, and he brought in their ideas. The justification for the war in Iraq. I mean, a lot of those ideas came from people who were working in these conservative think tanks, and the left needs people generating progressive ideas and pushing back. So it's really super important, and there's got to be more of it.
Without a doubt, there does. We mentioned Air America a moment ago. The first time I think that I found out that the Center for American Progress existed was when early in the days of Air America, when Al Franken, who spoke here earlier this morning, now as a senator from Minnesota, would have Christy
Lemperley
on from the Center for American Progress, and they would go through the right wing outrage of the week.
Krista Harvey, yes.
And they would have the right wing outrages of the week. And that was sort of my first wake up call that there finally was an infrastructure building that was going to keep up with this stuff so that we could build the rest of the infrastructure around it. And the Center for American Progress has done nothing but grow and grow and grow, and the need becomes greater. And you've hit the bigs when Limbaugh and O'Reilly and that crowd start whining about you.
Yes.
And I don't know what your culture is over there at the organization, but are you guys aware of the burr that you've become under the right wing saddle? I mean, it's got to be a badge of honor for you.
Well, I mean, I think to a certain extent we do. There are different parts of the center. There's we have the blog, we have an advocacy arm. Then we have the think tank, which is more sort of, it's
and
less.
And isn't there Progress Action or something like
that?
Yeah,
there's the Center for American Progress Action Fund, which can do sort of more straightforward lobbying and advocacy. I'm in the think tank part, which is more sort of, we're really digging deep on different policy issues. So on national security, I work largely in Afghanistan and Pakistan. So, I mean, and so it's a little bit different because it's not quite
We can do 2 hours on Afghanistan if you want.
We probably could. We could probably do about 2 days on Afghanistan.
Oh.
So it's a little bit different. But, yeah, I mean, I think our Think Progress folks fully get it, that they are being watched.
Stay out of small aircraft, that kind of thing.
Right, exactly. But, it is a badge of honor. It's because they know they're doing important work.
Well, let me, and I'm sorry to make you just sit there and gossip about your colleagues and stuff, but it's not every now and then. It's not just every day that I get to talk to one of my Center for American Progress heroes.
Yeah.
Because you all are doing God's work, so to speak. You're working among the angels. But within the think tank realm, and understanding that you're not a health policy analyst within the think tank, and I know you guys have one,
yes,
or two, or
do.
A dozen, I've seen manifested at least on the blog, like we talked about, some misgivings and some uncertainty. Is it generally consensus now? After the big essay that John Podesta wrote about supporting it, I mean, is everybody pretty much comfortable with where healthcare is going right now? When I heard the other day, and I've mentioned it in other conversations, well, we're in no hurry to pass healthcare now. Yeah, I'm a fairly reasonable guy. I'm not sitting here screaming like some right winger or anything, but I really did want to go and punch a wall or something when I heard that.
I don't know. I mean, my sense is that they want to move forward and they just want to pass it. But I can't speak for them because I don't know all the nuances from our team about sort of their comfort level with it. I just know that they feel like it's essential to pass a bill. And last night, just listening to President Obama, I think a lot of people in the healthcare community more broadly, at least on the left, were upset that he didn't make that a first priority. It was really far, far, far down the list, and I'm sure you guys have been talking about this. And he also sort of gave the sense that he was okay with there being more discussion about it, by basically saying to the Republicans in the room, if you guys have any great ideas, let me know. He was still sort of being open to continuing that, and I think people generally feel a little exhausted, but like enough
but
with
he,
it.
Hasn't he learned yet? I mean, this is a smart, smart man.
I don't know why at that point he's even giving them the opening. It seems like the conversation has been had. I mean, if you're trying to reason with people who are talking about death panels, I don't know where you go with that. I mean, they have so
well,
many.
Yeah, it's what Barney Frank said to the lady up in Massachusetts. It's like trying to have an argument with a dining room table.
Right. I mean, you can't have a logical discussion because there's not any openness. I thought he should have just said, let's do it, rather than.
Does he think that they're going to have some sort of road to Damascus moment and suddenly they're going to turn into people who actually want to advance the well-being of the American people as opposed to those people who are writing their checks? I mean, come on.
I mean, it was
please.
Such a hopeful conversation. It was such a hopeful speech. It was really like a...
They
it
always
was a real
are.
I know, and it was a real attempt to reach out and inspire hope, change calculations through inspiration, but we're probably not going to see it because none of that has worked in the past.
And just to because you have done such a yeoman job of standing in for maybe some of the healthcare folks from the center, let me give you a moment to shine in your own right.
Sure.
Why in God's name are we sending 30,000 more human beings into a meat grinder in Afghanistan?
It's a good question.
And this isn't because I'm some sort of tambourine shaking kumbaya loving hippie. This is because I read history.
Yeah.
And nothing
I
good
mean,
happens.
My sense is that it's the increase in the troop level doesn't solve your problem in Afghanistan. And I think that the Obama administration, they are hoping that this will create some sort of momentum to basically change the dynamics so that you can bring the Taliban to the table. You can get them to be more open to some sort of negotiations. But I think we heard last night, and we've heard again and again, especially now that we know the Pakistani military is not going to go after Afghan Taliban in their borders, you cannot kill your way out of this. It doesn't matter how many troops you have in Afghanistan, you are not going to beat these guys on the battlefield as long as they can continue to retreat to Pakistan. As long as they can continue to fundraise, to recruit, you're not going to win it. And so, at this point, I just hope that there can be alternatives that are pursued. Besides the, and this is, I think Obama gets this. They've got to figure out other ways to get American troops out besides just, it's a military battle. Even our general, Stanley McChrystal, top commander, U.S. commander there,
right,
says, he's open to reconciliation. He's open to reintegration. He says people are tired of fighting.
Well, didn't the Defense Department, didn't the Pentagon a few months ago confess that there was no way humanly possible to eliminate the Taliban?
Everybody gets that, and I think like our military, our civilian leaders understand that the Taliban have to be part of the solution now. They're talking a lot about other options. They recognize that this is not going to be a military solution.
Didn't we run butt against that right wing brick wall? You know what the response is going to be? Oh look, he wants to have a sensitivity session with them. See, that's the problem. You can't negotiate with them. The only thing you can do with them is kill them.
Right.
I mean, you know the script.
Yes.
You
heard. Yeah. No, it's true. I mean, it's definitely going to be used against Obama. It's interesting on this issue. The conservatives are really supportive of the. I mean, they're supportive of the 30,000 troops, right? Like, this needs to be the answer. But President Obama is pursuing things simultaneously. The troops just one part. But I mean, you even heard it tonight. I mean, the challenges are so huge. There's so many priorities. I mean, just listening, you're overwhelmed by everything that we need to do. National security is second, third, fourth on that list with everything else that needs to be done. Afghanistan has to be seen in the context of all the other challenges. If you can't put everything you have into Afghanistan. Not only are there other national security priorities, you have other issues.
We have a broken military now.
We have a broken economy. I mean, we have a broken healthcare system. But our educational system is a disaster.
It's broke.
Yeah, what's interesting to me is that national security is not, Biden Obama is not trying to make that number one. He sees the domestic issues as investing in those to make us stronger. That's got to be the first priority. That's how you become a strong country, is by increasing your economic competitiveness, by increasing the investment in education. And then the national security stuff is important, but it can't be your first, it's not the first thing you look to. So with Afghanistan, the issue is that what that country requires is so enormous. And I believe that I do not think we walk away at this point. That's my personal opinion. You've got to figure out how you do it within our
space. You know, you said it so well, Carolyn. We can't kill our way out of this problem. This is a problem that gets solved with water lines. This is a problem that gets solved with literacy programs. This is a problem that gets solved with not dragging 12-year-old boys out in the middle of the night and shooting them in the heads, in the head. Oh, my God. You know, that story did... But some of this may be beyond us, and the first part of wisdom is recognizing one's limitations.
Sure.
I'll find a way to get. I'll hunt you down. I'll get in touch, and we will spend an evening on Afghanistan.
Sure.
I hope sometime.
Sure.
First of all, this is not a conversation that's going to happen on Rush, and they're not too interested in nuance on O'Reilly. And the right, the right wing doesn't do think very well, but I like to think that we do.
Yes.
And having considered multi-layered conversations about these issues that are not handled well by bumper stickers at all, Afghanistan or bust,
Right.
Well, you just chose bust. I hope we can have a conversation
sure.
in the future.
Sure.
Carolyn,
thank you so much.
Very much. And please, my regards to all my heroes back at the center.
Definitely. Thank you very much.
All right. Bye.
Bye
now. Carolyn Wadhams from the Center for America Progress. And, that's no fake praise that I offer. I live and die at progress.org every night. And I really appreciate your dropping by for the conversation. One of your heroes to God, James, I know.
Absolutely. I don't know what we do without them. They're the almost soul representative of a committed think tank on the left.
Yeah, Media Matters does good work, but Think Progress, and they're media focused. Think Progress hits all the high points, and that's not to discount the wonderful work done by folks like John Amato over at Crooks and Liars. I love those guys. Bart Kopp's been there for a million years. But this is the Center for American Progress is something very, very special because it is a concerted effort to rebuild along liberal, progressive lines the machine that the right wing built 40 years ago that is choking us to death now.
Sure, and you just mentioned the other sites like Crooks and Myers and Barkhunt. They're all independents struggling to survive day to day.
Struggling to survive. It seems like I've lived that somewhere before.
Yes, it is. It is something familiar, isn't it? It's a constant battle. The guests that we've had on. It's money, Bob, and let's face it, the liberal community just doesn't stand up like the conservatives do. I don't know why that is for sure. I've never been able to completely understand it. Do you understand that?
No.
Because there's money on the left. There's a lot of money on the left. I recently...
You don't attend this thing in real... look at the money that went into this conference. And I'm not being critical.
Yeah,
but this thing being done at an extremely high level, this thing's being as professionally as it can be done. Everybody who does liberal video is here. Jeff Santos was doing his show, his Boston show, earlier this morning live. I am seated right now. I'm seated in literally in the midst of greatness. To my left is Guy James. And to my right, Tom Hartman sitting next to me.
Yes.
This is so cool.
Well, he's one of your big admirers.
Is he?
That's why he's that.
Oh, okay. I know.
Yeah, that's what he told me.
Oh, well, bless his heart.
But, getting back to what we're talking about, money.
Yeah.
You know this. Can I tell the Arzamanian story?
The which?
Arzamanian, the folks from...
I
shouldn't say their name, but...
Right.
Forget I said their name, all right? There's a couple in Naples, Florida. They are, and I'm not stretching it, I'm not exaggerating it or embellishing, they are billionaires.
That's with the
B. And they became Johnny-come-lately Democrats during the Obama run for the presidency. They were Republicans. And they fell in with Obama group and got on his finance committee, raised a lot of money. They're based in Naples, Florida, worth a fortune. Had talked
enough money to burn a wet elephant, as we like to
had
say.
Had talked to them about doing something with us.
Yeah.
had a lot of talks with him, and we're feeling pretty good about it. But I only realized that what people like them are interested in is not you and me or what we do.
Access
to presidency. They love to rub elbows with the upper echelon. They will have little to do with we peons. They regularly come to Washington and meet with the president and all that, but they don't do anything in the local party, nothing for local clubs, and regarding the talks about how to help out liberal radio, it's not just because we're not
sexy enough.
Yeah, and so that's a big problem. We recently had Vice President Biden, and they were at Diesel's. It was held these people's home. Raised, I don't know how many it cost. It cost to get in the door, grand to get a picture to him, and all that. But again, money, nothing to do with the Democrats to help the local situation. Nothing to do to help with it's access. Said but true. So there you have it.
Well, it's access. It is that idea that one is aside the inside of something.
More than happy to tell me, we're in our private plane to on Thursday and meet the president Thursday night. More than happy to tell you that. More than happy to tell you that.
Right. So, you know, you had all these meetings. What happened? Did they call and you forgot all back? I mean, what happened?
Finally just drifts away. It was first something that they wouldn't do and be polite and had dinner.
Mm-hmm.
I bought dinner.
Yeah.
It was not a cheap dinner.
No.
Why am I telling everybody this story? This is what we go through. I guess that's why I'm telling this. This is what we go through. Wine and dine people or whatever we can do to gain access to money when money's not interested in having access to us.
But you know what? That is not... That's not our fault.
Well, it is not. It is not our fault. We make the effort. We try and explain and educate these people.
And that's what it boils down to. It's our job to educate. You know, obviously, you know, Carolyn sat here. Carolyn gets it.
Absolutely. She
does. You know, there has to be product out there that Carolyn look at and say, see, look at that. And she talks to the boss, and the boss talks to somebody, and somebody talks to somebody. And next thing you know, we built a liberal infrastructure. But I say that at peril. Because while our good Tom Hartman next to us works at terrestrial radio, he is one of a relative small number who are able to. There is none infrastructure of liberal radio state in this country sufficient to drown out the right such machine.
And usually
the future of liberal talk in this country is here.
Well,
the horn is basically a time travel. We are, you know, we're working in the present, but we are the future of liberal radio.
Well, give me an example, if anybody will. Yes, there are people on terrestrial radio, but those that have been in the radio business for a lot of years, you know, there's a blowtorch. Example of one, and what I mean by a blowtorch is a big power station that really gets all over the place. Give me an example of one with liberal radio.
I don't know that there are.
I don't know.
All and the technical for it is a 50,000 watt AM clear channel. I don't know where there are. I don't know that are running liberal radio.
I don't either.
You know, there's WW in Cincinnati.
Hardcore
Right Wing as the day's long.
Oh, man.
WWL in New Orleans. Not such.
WLS in Chicago.
WLS Chicago.
WBZ.
Yeah. There's the monster in Cleveland, St. Louis, the KMOX. And there's no liberal coming on any of those.
So when we talk about it, like in, say, he's sitting next to Tom Hartman, who I the world know of Tom, he's on some stage. But by and large, they're not, you know, it's not, and Schultz is, you know, what's his name? The omnipotent Mr. Schultz.
Who is not here?
He's not here. Too good for the rest of them, too big.
Yeah, exactly.
And I say that love in my heart. Because I know, and I having, you know, have been in close proximity with Mr. Sim, we love him dearly.
By the way, a little bit of sad news our way. I don't know if you've seen this or not. The man who did so very much to at least bring some forgotten American history to the fore of life has passed away. Howard Zinn.
Oh.
80s or so years old.
Pat Howard on show.
Our buddy Michael from the chat room shooting me a note hours back. He said it was the spin of Democracy Now! Podcast. Howard Zinn's People's History of the United States absolutely changed the way that I view country. Not because he was advocating against it, but simply because he was people's history, the history of the people of the United States. And it is so profound. Stuff like Blair Mountain, stuff like Haymarket Massacre, all of those things that are not taught, that are forgotten, that should be taught. And the country has Howard Zinn to thank for the fact that it's even known.
The Greek people have a saying when someone's elderly. Howard was, what, 87, you say?
Yeah, that's what Michael said.
Yeah, the Greek people have a saying for that he got all of his loaves of bread. 87's a good age, and although that's a good age, we still miss the effect that man has had on this country's people.
Sad business. Let's see, I'm scheduled here. What do I get my next guest?
Well, let me look it over here.
Well, hold on. I was going to ask you, could you hold that for long enough for me to make a brief disappearance?
No.
Okay, well, thanks. It'll be dead air.
We'll sing the songs.
Well, okay, sing for him. I've got to go find water, or else I'm going to be croaking like by the time this is over.
Some water. We get the schedule and see what the guest should be around 2:30. It should be Turnbull. She's right over there. She is the chairman of the Maryland right now. She was the vice of the DNC.
Okay.
And now she's the Maryland. She's a friend of mine.
Is she on your list as well?
I hope so. I love talking to her. We were having a private discussion here a while ago. She's good friends with my cousin.
Understood.
Treasurer of the Ed.
If you could just man fort for a couple of minutes.
Well, right.
While I run away and find some little water.
And I'll find.
Do you hear
something?
You know.
Yeah, because we're kind of doing like a tandem tag team thing here.
Precisely. So I'm gonna quiet my mic, and you'll just hold down the fort, and we'll get back at it. All right.
Yes. Thanks. We would do that. We're in a room, a quit room, for those of you that we haven't really tried this, what Radio Row is like. It's something everybody ought to see. I wish we had a webcam going here. It's a madhouse, every Radio Row that I've ever been to. And that's just the nature of the beast. We have tables up with microphone all over the place, and I'm sure you can hear out of the noise in the background. And we have schedulers who schedule guests for us. And it's like being a puzzle together. I'm lucky enough to have Paul Begala a little later on. I really admire the guy. And so we're going to have him on. And I think around 3:05, we'll come up with my show. And Susie Turnbull's here, like I said, chairman of the Maryland Democratic Party, former vice chair of the DNC. And we see Stephanie here that works in Nancy Pelosi's office. We've implored her many times to get Nancy on the radio, and we keep getting the answer. Nancy, do no radio. And she really doesn't. She doesn't TV either, I don't think. And we see people, the typical schmoozer go pick up the most famous people and try and schmooze them like, you know how it goes. But it's an interesting scene. And we sit right beside each other, and while you hear the noise, there's probably a dozen tables in here. And some people are broadcasting back to terrestrial radio. A couple of us are doing internet radio. In fact, Bob and I might be the only ones doing internet radio. I'm not sure. We got somebody here. What's happening? Yes. Bob for a little break. He's going to be back in a minute. And the guy Jando starts at 3 o'clock. We're both on the same network, so we're kind of doing a tag team thing here today. So I don't know. So we're doing a tag team thing here today. We're on the same network. Bob had to step out for just a couple of minutes. He'll be back shortly. Yeah, I'm going in for him for a couple of minutes. Well, he had to go out and get some water. Yeah, he's great live radio. We've got our a bio in his schedule here, and I'm not sure what time. I don't know whether he's got the schedule today or tomorrow. I'm not sure. Start with live radio going over. Robert Wiener is in an on-air analysis for Battleline Media. It's tomorrow. Okay. And that's part of the, what I was explaining to everybody, that radio rows are awfully chaotic. They're always chaotic. Let me say it that way. They are always chaotic. So it's just like putting a big puzzle together, and I must be driving you crazy with my explanation of all this right now. Bedtime for Bonzo says that I'm going to Tom's check room for a while in the lobby to get Tom to say hello to Guy and Bob. Is that good or poor? No, it's a good idea as long as he doesn't have a guest he's interviewing. Susie Turnbull right now. I think Susie's going to be coming over here with her next interview. One of my favorite people in Washington, D.C., an engaging personality. He was vice chair at the DNC when Terry McAuliffe was in, and Howard Dean. So she has seen the DNC from one end to the other. What did you think of the State of the Union last night? Bob and I stood on the corner down at the Fogo de Chão and watched the motorcade go by and kind of came to a consensus that maybe they ought to scuttle the State of the Union thing. Is it worth it? Is it worth the money and the time and the falderall they have just to put this thing together when it's really just so much fluff? It seems to me it is so much fluff. It's a political speech, albeit a good one last night. But was anything accomplished last night? Was anything accomplished by once again extending a hand to the Republicans? I think not. I don't think anything is accomplished, and it is beyond me, absolutely beyond me, why our president seems to continue on trying to extend a friendly hand to the Republicans when it's just not going to happen. You know that. I know that. And just don't understand why that he doesn't realize that. I just don't know. Yes, we're on live right now. So, it's just interesting to me that he continues to do that, and I don't get it. I really don't. I would have quit by now. Maybe he knows something I don't know. He must know something I don't know. Because in my life, and probably you too, when you try and make friends with somebody and you are turned away time after time after time, sooner or later you say, to hell with it. I'm not getting anywhere with this. I'm not going to waste my time with this anymore. But he continues on with that, so I guess that's his business. But it's our business, too. Anything that's the president's business is our business. Bob went out to find some water. Don't know if he had any luck or not. The chaos continues here in the room. A lot of good speakers at the event this weekend. Well, it's not weekend yet. Today and tomorrow. And I guess anybody who is involved in liberal radio whatsoever is here. I know a lot of these folks. Some of them I've never seen before and have no idea who they are. So that's just, again, the nature of liberal radio. There are no big stars, Tom probably being the star of liberal radio right now. But they are falling by the wayside, and it was no surprise to see what happened with Air America. I was very familiar with that situation, had spoken to the owners and management of that company for some time, the former owners and the most recent owners, and Charlie Kirker and his brother, and it was never to be. The money just isn't there. They bought that company for a little bit of nothing, a couple of million dollars. Really didn't own any assets of any kind, no stations. It just was not to be. It's not a good business venture, I know that. It was not run very well, I know that. I don't know why I'm saying all this stuff, but it just wasn't going to happen. And the advertising money just was not there. Simply not there. Somebody brought up the fact that Randy is sort of a star. I haven't heard anything about Randy Rhoads, and I don't know when. don't even know what she's doing now. I think I know she is doing radio, but I don't know what kind of an audience she has or anything. She's somebody I haven't heard about for a long time. I think ever since that phony attack thing happened, and she suckered John Elliott into going along with it and reporting on it, I think she's lost a lot of her shine. One thing for sure, you can count us on us here at Head On Radio Network to tell it like it is. That's for certain. Bob is out right now, and he'll be back very shortly. I was broaching the subject. What did you think of the speech last night? I thought it was very good. I mentioned we saw the motorcade and we watched some of the speech. I just don't know what it means. I don't know what the value of it is anymore. I think it's something that's probably it's passed us by, and I don't think we need to do it anymore. It's good to hear an inspiring speech and all that, but when you know what the result is going to be, and when you understand after years and years of building cynicism in this country, you understand that the result of it is practically nothing. And that's just how it is, practically nothing. See, Bob comes back empty-handed. He went for water, and he comes back with none. You mean there's no water here? I guess that's what he means. We're talking for 6 hours and we have no water. Bob, this cannot go on. It cannot go on. 6 hours with no water. I could sit here 6 hours with no water, but I couldn't talk for 6 hours with no water. Susie Turnbull is coming over right now. She's the next guest. She's at, yes, she's on, coming up right now. Bob, do you know Susie?
We've never had the pleasure of meeting before. Hi, Susie. Bob Kincaid.
If you want to know what's going on in Washington, particularly you want to know what goes on behind the scenes and plain talk for average Joe lunch bucket American, Susie's the person to talk to.
Well, it sounds like you are a perfect candidate for conversation radio, Susie.
Great.
Thank you so much for joining us. You're the chair of the Maryland Democratic Party. And so this is kind of home turf for you.
This is home turf, and I am the former vice chair of the Democratic National Committee.
Right.
So
I've been doing this
for a while.
Yeah. I recognized your name from national circles. I didn't realize you were chairing the Maryland party. Let's start, if you don't mind. And we've got headphones there for you if you'd like. They are not mandatory.
No, it's better.
let's just start with... The purpose of this conference, healthcare, working American families. Do you, given what you know to be going on, are we gonna get it? Is there going? Do you think there's going to be a bill land on the president's desk?
Yes, and I think so. I don't know what that bill is going to include, and I don't think anyone here who says that they know what it's going to include can be accurate at this point, but I think there's got to be a few major principles that will be included. One, clearly dealing with the issue of getting more people insured. The second, the issue of pre-existing conditions. I think those are two things that I think are clear that have to happen.
You know, I've referenced on a number of occasions throughout my conversations this afternoon the thing that just brought everything into a very stark relief for me was that Harvard study that was released a couple of months back, peer-reviewed, solid science. Nothing, you know, there's nothing the right wing can say. Well, you know, that's just liberal science. Science is neutral, and we know from that there are 45,000 Americans who will die this year. There were 45,000 Americans who died last year. Not because they had a condition that was too hard to treat. Not because the doctors were baffled.
but simply because they did not have access to health care via some level of coverage.
There's a famous story, actually. It's a true story of a little boy in Prince George's County, Maryland, which is just outside of Washington, D.C., a few years ago, who had a toothache.
Yes.
And he died from the infection because he couldn't get to go to see the dentist.
Right.
And I think that's the kind of story that hits home with all of us. And I know our leaders in Maryland, in Congress and elsewhere, made sure that never again would that happen in our state.
You know, I have a tremendous degree of respect for Dr. Dean. And I'm very much a universal single-payer advocate. I believe our side needs that kind of advocacy in order to make sure that what does come down the pike has some level of applicability to the broad spectrum of what we need in healthcare in this country. But given and being someone who has the respect for Dr. Dean that I have, how do we square liberals, progressives, how do we square up the need for universal single payer with what's going through the Congress right now?
Well, I think for me, I look back a year ago, and a year ago at the same conference, there was a lot of discussion about the SCHIP program, which was the state children's health insurance program, that President Bush had vetoed, I think, twice or three times.
Right.
And shortly after the conference, SCHIP was passed, and 11 million more children were included on the insurance rolls. And so I think of that as great progress that has been sort of in the midst in the discussions about health care. I also think about the issues that my senator, Senator Barbara Mikulski, raises, which is gender neutrality. And whereas for some women sometimes can't get coverage because they have a pre-existing condition. They have
that may have been
pregnancy.
Right.
Which is just absurd and ridiculous. And so what's to square things in my own head, because I believe everyone has the right and that health care is a right,
yes,
not a privilege. It is a right. It's going to take time from the standpoint of moving the ball incrementally. And if it is going to be something, if moving it too far, too fast, means that we're going to lose people and it's going to be turned around with the next election so that all is lost, I think that's a real problem.
Well, in terms of the gender neutrality that you mentioned, and I agree wholeheartedly with you on it, What about things like the Pitt Stupak business and people like Ben Nelson who presume to draw a line in the sand over being able to control women's insides? I can't tell you that, you know, that's rend my garments, sit in sackcloth and ashes and run screaming around the room stuff for me. And it makes me say ugly, nasty things like what a dino he is. If that is still in the mix, and I'm not trying to be overly negative, but if that's still in the mix, is it still a health care bill?
I don't think it's going to – I'm hopeful that it's not in the mix. I'm hopeful that that whatever comes out is designed in a way so that abortion does not become a key factor in this discussion in these discussions. I actually participated last week on Capitol Hill with discussions with members of Congress who voted for Stupak and claimed to be pro-choice. Which is mind-boggling. Basically saying to them, and this was last Wednesday, and saying to people, it's one thing to say there had been an amendment offered and approved, basically, by Lois Capps from Santa Barbara, California, which had basically kept abortion neutral. so that federal funds would not be used for abortion. Well, what Stupak did and what Stupak picked and what Nelson, Senator Nelson are trying to do is change change it so that it's almost impossible for a woman of moderate means or low income to ever get an abortion. And that's just unacceptable.
Well, it's past that. It, the hypocrisy of it is stunning, in, among other things, the fact that it wasn't just Representative Stupak, who is ostensibly a Democrat, but it was Representative Pitts, who was very definitely a Republican, who crafted this amendment, and then Congressman Pitts didn't vote for it, and he didn't vote for the final bill, even after. And at what point in time does this noble attempt at bipartisanship, at what point do we chuck it out the window and say, enough?
And I think that the president did some of that last night by basically looking people in the face and saying, and looking at the Republicans in the Senate in particular and saying, excuse me, enough's enough. And, I think he said it is good politics, but it is better policy that we include, we have a bipartisan approach to stuff. But you can't have a bipartisan approach to legislation if every member of one of the parties only says no. You cannot have that. And to expect compromise based on, well, maybe we'll vote for something, is no longer acceptable, I think. And I hopefully there's going to be a change. There were times in the president's speech last night while I was alone, my husband was out of town, and I was sitting in front of the television applauding when the president basically said, enough is enough, and I'm a fighter, and we're going to move forward.
Well, there is this perception, Susie, that that he has been somewhat passive in the process in the last year, and I hope you understand that I'm not out here to bash Barack Obama, to be bashing Barack Obama. I voted for him. I certainly wanted him much more than, you know, I've told people on the air that every time I get frustrated with the president, I have this little scenario that runs through my brain.
It could be John McCain.
Well, not only that. No. Let me. Remember that old Alice Cooper song, "Welcome to My Nightmare." Being what I am and what we do, I hear this thing in my head. This is a special report from CBS News. And then the very serious voice says, "We regret to inform you that President McCain has just succumbed from his long battle with cancer. We take you now to the White House, where Sarah Palin is being sworn in as President of the United States." And all of a sudden, I'm okay with Barack Obama again. But with that having been said, I don't bash him to be bashing him. But, and there's always a but, you want a greater level of engagement. You want him to be the guy that was on the campaign trail, and I know that's very difficult.
And I think what we heard and saw last night is that he recognizes, which is something that George Bush could never recognize, ever making a mistake. And I think that the president pretty much said he made a mistake by not having his own bill, by having Congress do their work, which is a logical thing to do, which is basically, I was just on a phone call a few minutes ago, and I also heard David Axelrod from the White House say, the Republicans are trying to make 60 the new 50,
mm-hmm.
which is sort of a funny way to look at it. Who would have ever imagined that September 20th, 2008, we were in horrific economic crisis. Literally, the financial markets were in terrible shape.
Imploded.
And the Democrats and the Republicans worked together. There was a Republican president, a Republican Secretary of Treasury, and Bernanke, who was a Republican appointee, heading this up. And the Democrats stepped up and worked to
We're prone protect, to doing that.
Yeah, protect the economy. And now we look at who would expect a year later to look at it and recognize that the Republicans would not step up to save our health care system. Who would ever believe it?
Sadly, Susie, I would, because they don't see it as saving the health care system. They see it as... And let me
or
ask,
saving our economy.
But let me ask you, as a seasoned veteran of some pretty bare-knuckled politics, when they talk this business about Obama's a Marxist, Obama's a socialist, when they do that stuff, do they really... Do they believe that, or do they know that they're just throwing out their they're throwing red meat out there for their cannon fodder in the culture wars?
I can't imagine them really believing it. First of all, so many of them, the senators in particular, serve with him in the United States Senate. They know of him as a thoughtful person who they worked with. So that's number one. For people like Michelle Bachmann, who is a congresswoman from Minnesota, who basically claims periodically that he wasn't born in this country. She is part of the birther movement, and who basically was accusing other Democratic and Republican members of Congress of being disloyal to the United States. And she's a true believer. She believes that nonsense. I think more Americans don't, and most Americans want to see these adults playing well together. And that's something that I heard the president say very clearly, and hopefully the message was taken.
Well, and sadly it's not a class that is limited to extremists like Michelle Bachmann, because you and I can both sit here and tick off Michelle Bachmann, Marsha Blackburn, John Linder, you know, this is,
right.
And then...
I mean, I have a congressman...
Dozens of them.
...in Maryland. We have one Republican congressman who basically, if one would look at his voting record, it would be almost every single vote is no, regardless of what the issue is. And if you don't have a solution yourself, and you are only going to vote no, how do you expect to move from A to B? And right now, people are struggling. They don't have, they want to be able to send their kids to college. They want to have a job.
But process-wise, a guy who builds a career out of voting no, how does he bring anything home to his district? Because that's the ultimate measure of his worth.
Oh, I'll give you one even better. There are those who are saying, no earmarks. We can't have earmarks. But when they put the earmark in, or we don't like the American Recovery Act, it was worthless, but let me stand here and give you the $500,000 that this grant with a big cardboard check in my community. I'm so proud to bring home this bacon, which they voted against, And that is the total hypocrisy.
Is that procedural? Is that also a failure of leadership to allow that to happen?
Well, basically,
and I guess what I'm asking you, Susie, is are there no consequences?
What we're doing, and I think the Democratic Party and our campaign committees are going to do, is make it very clear that these members of Congress are coming home and are being total hypocrites. Total hypocrites. If you vote against something, don't stand there and say how you brought it home.
Exactly.
And which part don't you want? Do you not want to fix that bridge at the end of your street that could collapse? Which part of this doesn't make sense? The highways that are crumbling and cost you every day with your car? I once was on a plane many years ago when Dennis Hastert was Speaker of the House, and he had made some comments about taxes at one point, and I was sitting on the plane thinking, so which part don't you like? The fact that you have staff here with you, that the government is paying for that person to fly with you? When you get off, when we're on the plane, there's air traffic controllers who are keeping you safe. If you get off the plane, you're going to be driving on federal highways. Which part don't you want taxes
why,
to pay for?
Why are we no good at that message?
I don't know.
And I mean,
and it's Secretary Madeleine Albright once said, Democrats say everything's complicated. People ask them a question and they say it's complicated. It's not complicated. You need to pay taxes so that we have services.
But we have, but to echo Madeleine Albright, we have a culture. We have a culture within the Democratic Party that if you ask them what time it is, they tell you how to build a watch.
That's what she's saying.
And what
we have to say it's simple. Which part of this don't you like? And when I think about being on an airplane, so do I not want air traffic controllers? I don't think so.
I'm kind of fond of a federal regulation that says that my pilot can't have a hangover.
That's pretty good too. one of the things that we saw the other day in Haiti, the issue with they had one airstrip, and so they had to shut off planes coming into Haiti with water and food and medical supplies because there was no air traffic control. And that, to me, was one of the biggest clear-cut examples of what we need.
Well, Susie, thank you so much for coming by. And it's a real joy to make your acquaintance.
It's a great,
wonderful conversation we've had, and I hope we get to have more. Thank you for being here today and being part of the Horn.
Great. Thanks. Good to be here.
Take care. And coming our way, I told him to waved at him, and then he disappeared on me. Guy James will track down Michael Rugnetta, a research assistant from the Progressive Bioethics Initiative. He's the research assistant for Jonathan Moreno for the Progressive Bioethics Initiative. He's from Philadelphia, and he has done significant work in developmental psychology, religion, politics. He's also an old theater junkie. Right. All right, sorry for the dead air there. We're just trying to sort out what's happening and what's going to happen. And so much of this happens on the fly, and we're just awaiting the arrival of our next guest, who will be, we've heard from a couple of policy analysts for Families USA. The man who runs the entire operation is Ron Pollack, and he is here with us right now. Ron, thank you very much for taking time to join us on the Horn.
Yeah, delighted to join you.
We are indeed delighted to have you with us. First of all, let me thank you for putting together this marvelous event. You've done it year in and year out now, and it's a vital piece of the debate, and I think you've gone a long way in shaping the terms of how we address these issues. And the issue has changed from year to year. Are you satisfied with the progress we're seeing?
You know, we have moved.
And there's headphones there if you'd like.
We have moved further than we ever have in the history of our nation in getting health reform passed. We've passed legislation on the floor of the House and on the floor of the Senate, despite a filibuster by Republicans. That has never happened in the almost 100 years since Teddy Roosevelt first tried to achieve this. I believe we're going to get this done, and I was really delighted that the President, during the State of the Union message, made it clear that he's not turning back. And I spoke to so many House members who said they're determined to get this across the finish line. So I'm very happy with the way this is proceeding.
Are you satisfied with the fact that we're going to make this? The only way I know to refer to it is an incremental process where we start with something and work toward more.
Well, you know, let's go back a little bit in history.
Sure.
One of the things that many folks celebrate was the passage of the Social Security Act in 1935.
Absolutely.
Well, guess what?
Done with no Republican help, I might add.
Well, guess what? The Social Security Act, when it was passed, did not cover agricultural workers. The Social Security Act, when it passed, did not include domestic workers. If you go down the line of all the different groups it did not cover when it passed in 1935, you exclude, by the way, vast majorities of people from communities of color. The legislation passed, and with each succeeding year, some of these exclusions were changed.
Sure.
So we've got to build a foundation. And starting with a foundation of adding coverage of 31 to 37 million people who don't have coverage today, I think is extraordinary. So I would truly celebrate passing this legislation, even with imperfections, because we are going to deal with those imperfections in future years.
Are you convinced that it will be passed?
I believe it is going to be to pass. I think for Democrats, it would be a real political travesty. Forget the social travesty that will occur for all the people who've been hurt by America's healthcare system or uninsured, who've been denied coverage by an insurance company due to pre-existing conditions, or had coverage and went to big debt despite that and possible bankruptcy. But from a political standpoint, the Democratic Party would be really hurt if it fails to pass health reform, and they'd be hurt for two reasons. Number one, the Republicans and the conservative opponents of reform will continue to criticize reform. And the only way the American public is ultimately going to rally around it is once they understand what's in the legislation and how it's going to help them.
And in fact, once they experience it, wouldn't you say?
Absolutely. But there's a second reason, and that is, you know, Barack Obama and Democrats came into power on the theme of change. We're going to produce change. Well, you can't assume the mantle of change if you don't produce change.
Change, yes.
And so it's very important for Democrats that they get this job done.
We have heard in the last couple of days statements like, we're in no hurry, which if it was frustrating to me, it had to be twice as much to you. We're in no hurry to pass health care now. Do you get a sense, this being a midterm election year, do you get a sense for when it might happen?
It's going to happen in the next weeks. It's got to happen in this session of Congress. And I think the momentum in terms of getting this done is now growing again. It dropped after the elections in Massachusetts, no question. It was a big bump in the road. But I think Democrats are getting over their first stage of grief. And I think that there's increased determination to get it done. It's going to happen this year.
You sound fairly confident that that the votes exist in the House. What about in the Senate?
I think the votes are going to be there in both bodies. Now, there's going to probably be a two-step process to this, and I don't know the precise sequencing of it. But once the Senate and House leadership and the President reach agreement about how to work out the differences between the two bills, and they announce that, then there'll be a two-step process. One step will involve passing the Senate bill. Once that happens on the House floor, it becomes law. Then there will be an additional bill which will embody the compromise that's been worked out to resolve the differences between the two bills. And that will pass through a process we call reconciliation. And what's meant by that?
So you think reconciliation is going to be
a component of this process. And by the way, since the budget legislation was passed in the mid-1970s, that process has been used over two dozen times for major things. And President Bush used it for his big tax cuts in 2001 and 2003.
Absolutely.
Yes, I think reconciliation will be the vehicle by which you resolve the differences between the two. But the Senate bill will be passed, and that does not require another vote in the Senate.
So despite the degree to which the right wing has screamed unprecedented, once again, they are, in a word, lying, to use the reconciliation process to pass health care would not be any sort of anything out of the way.
Not at all. I mean, the Republicans have used this process on a number of occasions, including in the Bush administration, to pass some of the most controversial legislation. And for my friends who are here, who've been working on health care, the very popular Children's Health Insurance Program,
right,
which is expensive. That was passed through reconciliation. So this
Absolutely.
Is not an unusual process.
Well, Mr. Pollack, I thank you very much for taking time to come by and chat with us on the horn. I thank you and your entire staff for everything you've done here, and more importantly, for what you've done to advance health care in this country. And I hope we'll all be celebrating in another month's time.
Well, I look forward next time being on with you after we pass reform.
That's going to be a very happy day, isn't it?
You bet.
Ron Pollack, thank you very kindly.
Bye-bye.
Bye now. Director of Families USA, that's Ron Pollack, and you know what? That's also my time for the day. I am what you call a done doggy. I will pass the microphone over to my able colleague, Guy James, and let him run and see. He gets the really cool. He's got cool guests coming. He got Paul Begala on the way. See, it doesn't work unless it's on.
You know they've only got me scheduled for 5 o'clock, though. Did you know that?
Oh, I thought that's what they had. Yeah,
I just found that out. Okay. Okay. Okay.
Yes. Yeah, so
what do you mean I get the really cool guests?
Well, I mean,
you had some really good guests.
I had great guests.
And you were great with them.
Well, you know,
don't get the fat head, but you were.
Well, thank you very kindly.
You get the best out of these people.
That's why we call it conversation radio.
Without hitting them or anything.
Yeah. Nobody saw what was going on. I was stomping toes under the table here.
Well, okay, where's the opening music?
Okay. Well, the opening music doesn't happen until I play the closing music. Okay.
Okay. Play the closing music, and then you're gonna play the Guy James Show opening.
Yeah. Exactly.
All right. I'll wait.
Okay. Why don't you do that? Guy James, talk show host in waiting, but thanks, everybody. We'll catch you tomorrow at about noonish and be with you then. And let me simply say thanks to everybody who makes this happen. And always, 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 Gina, it's all for you.
Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of the sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Looky, everybody, it's Monday. I'm Bob Kincaid. This is The Horn, the Head On Radio Network. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com is our home, but you can get the streams not only there, but at the usual source, WhiteRoseSociety.org. You can get the streams at iTunes Radio. You can get the streams at Stitcher Radio. You can get the streams at TuneIn Radio and Tuner Internet Radio. My goodness gracious, there are places all over the series of tubes where you can get the Head On Radio Network stream. And I invite you to try any one you wish or any number you wish just to find which one suits your needs best. I've found on various incarnations of mobile phones, Tuner Internet Radio and TuneIn Radio seem to be my best bets, as well as Stitcher. It's always reliable as well. So, wow, just forging boldly into the future. That's what we're doing here. This is The Horn. We call what we do here Conversation Radio. And you'll find out why in fairly short order. So hang in, sit back, hang out, talk to the speakers, work on dinner, whatever, build a model airplane or a ship in a bottle. I don't care as long as you're there and as long as you share your thoughts, your ideas, and your conversation, either by email or by the phone or by the chat room. Head on radionetwork.com/chatrooms. A great place to hang out for the next 3 hours. You'll find it a quite merry and enjoyable crowd there, without a doubt. And that's free. It's free. Or, you know, if it suits you, just stand outside and scream at the heavens. Some of it may just wash back at us. One never knows. If you will take a gander, now that we are on, it's the 9th of April, take a gander over to headonradionetwork.com, right there on the main page. You will find that via the handy-dandy graphic widget hickey thing that John Fox put up, right above the PayPal button, you'll see that we have cleared $580 for the month. And so that leaves us $45 short as of the 7th day of April, and this week we've got to bring in another $625, so any hope, any help, maybe that was a Freudian slip, any help you can give will be much, much appreciated. Now, tonight, you know already that we don't do a lot of guests on this program. Oh, by the way, Isaac pointing out also free internet radio via Shoutcast Radio. You can, no. I can't submit our station to them, our network to them, Isaac, because they only work on Shoutcast, and we are an IceCast. We're an IceCast production. IceCast is, what, if I understand, let's see if I can put this correctly. IceCast is open sourced, whereas Shoutcast, you pay literally by the minute. And in light of the previous fundraising note, if we had to do that, we'd probably wind up being off the air. So, to get back to what I was saying, I mentioned this on Friday, and we confirmed this over the weekend. And I am very, very pleased that we're going to be joined in a matter of a few minutes by the author of both 1491 and 1493, Mr. Charles C. Mann. If you've been listening for about the last 2 months, you've heard me speak glowingly. Well, you've heard me for years speak glowingly of 1491. I'd say if we compiled a top 10 list of relevant books, at least for us here, The Horn, 1491 would be high on that list, as is 1493. Basically, in 1493, what you're going to find out is that 200 million or so years ago, or to the fundamentalists, two weeks ago, about 2:16 on a Thursday, what had been a single continent on this planet separated into a number of little different pieces and began developing and evolving entirely separately. Now, that's where you get to the 1491 versus 1493 dichotomy. It is after the arrival of Christopher Columbus, or any of his other varied names, in the autumn of 1492 in what became known as the West Indies, that divergence that happened 200 million years before began closing. And it is what has been documented both in the previous magnificent work, 1491, and the present magnificent work, 1493, is the summary of effects.
there's a tendency to say, well, this is fascinating history, but it's not history. This is fascinating ecology, but it's not all ecology. Oh, look at the anthropology. No, it's not that either. It's everything. It's the kind of book that the moment you set it down, your eyes sort of spin. If you're reading it on a Kindle or some other e-reader, you find yourself highlighting to come back again and again and again. And I know several of you have already purchased the book, and I'm glad, because I think it will further that we'll have our little book club corner here. For instance, I got an email from our good friend Mike, and he wrote in and said, after hearing you talk about Charles C. Mann's books so much over the last few weeks, I purchased 1491 for my Kindle. Holy cow, I knew some of this history, but not enough. I forget if I've mentioned this to you before, but before getting into psychology, I majored in history in college. I graduated with a dual BA in psych and history. I attended a very small, very conservative Christian college. I never fit in. Long story as to how I got there, but it had to do with a high school girlfriend who wanted to attend there, and I applied there too because I wanted to be with her. I got in, and she didn't. Oops, end of that relationship. I ended up meeting some wonderful people, most of whom didn't really fit in either, and I still count them among my closest friends. But the ultra-conservative atmosphere always bugged me. Anyway, Bob, on the last day of the first semester of my freshman year, the professor in my World History 101 class asked us if there was any part of world history we felt he hadn't covered sufficiently. I raised my hand and said that I would have liked to learn more about the history of the Western Hemisphere prior to Columbus. I still remember his reaction and that of the rest of the class. I remembered it to this day. It was the first time I'd ever really been humiliated in a classroom. I barely had the sentence out of my mouth before he started laughing and said, "There wasn't any!" I swear to you, Bob, the whole class laughed for about a minute. I never took a class with him again. Anyway, thanks for yet another good book recommendation. I hope you have had a happy holiday, and I hope you did as well, Mike. We had a lovely holiday here. The barbecue that we talked about on Friday with Brother Albert was magnificent. Hot and spicy slaw to go with it. Yeah, good eats all the way around on a lovely, lovely Easter Sunday. So without further ado, let's go to the phones, where I do believe Mr. Mann is standing by, and enough shilly-shallying for me. Let's hear from him about his tremendous, tremendous work. Are you with us, Mr. Mann?
Yes, I am. Thank you for the kind words.
Oh, thank you for joining us. This is like a conversation with a rock star to me. So forgive me, but the work that you have done in pulling both of these books together is tremendous. And as I explained some time back and noted in my email to you, when I tried to get you on the air for 1491, you said I'd be happy to, but I'm in China. And I thought, what's he doing in China? Now I know. Obviously, you were researching a significant portion of 1493. Let's start, if you don't mind. Well, we'll have to talk a little bit about 1491 as well, I think. But let's start with the new word I learned when I opened 1493, the homogenocene. Can you tell us what that is?
Well, that's a term that some biologists use to describe the period after Columbus. And what they mean is, kind of like you were saying at the beginning of the show, that, you know, for a couple hundred million years, the continents were completely separate, and as a result, they ended up with completely different suites of, of plants and animals. And what Columbus did, you know, the reason he's important if you're a biologist, is he recreated Pangaea, the original continent. He brought together the various separate pieces of the world and created this ecological convulsion in which huge numbers of creatures from over there came over here, and huge numbers of creatures from over here went over there, and this enormous explosion is the homogeneity, is the time when all the world's different ecosystems were homogenized. And that's what it refers to, this great process of homogenization that's slowly taking place and is still occurring today.
And it really was a Pandora's box that cannot be closed, wasn't it? Because not only you catalog very well what the effect has been of the migration of both flora and fauna, but it's really hard to understand what was lost and what was replaced. Is there any way of putting that into words? I mean, what the New World looked like before Columbus, or imagining an Italy without a tomato, or a Germany or an Ireland without a potato, or even an Afghanistan without the pumpkin?
Well, there's, you know, it really is hard to imagine. I mean, here, I live in Western New England, you know, and it's really amazing to me to consider what I would be eating now if I could only eat things that originated in Western New England. My diet would be pretty different from what it is now. If you think about it, in this part of the world, you know, in the Americas, as a result of events that took place about 15,000 years ago that we don't really understand, there are very, very few domesticable animals. So there are no cattle, there are no horses, there are no sheep, there are no goats, there's no poultry. There's none of the familiar domestic animals that we know of today. And so, you know, people who lived here lived, you know, without all of those kinds of animals. Similarly, if you go over to Europe, they didn't have, you know, some estimates are two-thirds of the kinds of, you know, fruits and vegetables that they eat today. They didn't, they had wheat and barley, but they didn't have potatoes. They didn't have any kind of peppers. They didn't have squash. They didn't have tomatoes. I mean, the list goes on and on. And that's just foods. Then one of the biggest changes was that there's completely different disease environments on the different parts of the world. Because there are domesticated animals in Europe and Asia and Africa, and there weren't in the Americas had very few of what are called zoonotic diseases. And that's a sort of a, you know, a $3 word meaning an animal disease that jumps the species barrier, as scientists say, and becomes a human disease. And most of the great killers in human history are that kind of disease, where people living close to farm animals caught a mutated version of a farm disease, and then it spread through the air. And so smallpox, influenza, measles, all of them are mutated animal diseases. And the result, then the first thing that happened for the Columbian Exchange, one of the greatest events, was that when Europeans came across the Atlantic, they inadvertently brought over these huge numbers of diseases with them. Whereas Europeans had been swimming in this kind of bacterial and viral soup for thousands and thousands of years, people in this part of the world hadn't, and the results were catastrophic when that bacterial and viral soup were introduced. And in the first 150 years or so after Columbus, somewhere between two-thirds and 90% of the original inhabitants of the Americas died. It was the worst demographic catastrophe in human history, and it goes a long way to explaining why small groups of Europeans, poorly supplied Europeans, you know, poorly equipped Europeans, at the end of very long supply chains, were able to prosper in environments that were completely unlike anything they had seen before.
But they were not unscathed either. You go to great detail to describe the various vectors by which malaria and yellow fever entered the New World, and that didn't just affect the native population. It was certainly hard on the white folks too, wasn't it?
Absolutely. And in fact, there's this broad band of the Americas, roughly speaking, from Chesapeake Bay, you know, Washington D.C., all the way down across the equator to southern Brazil, where particularly virulent forms of malaria and yellow fever became common. They're introduced from various parts of Europe and Asia and Africa. And it became very difficult for Europeans to survive. And this played a huge role in the development of the slave trade, because Africans, people from Central and West Africa, are more immune to malaria than yellow fever for genetic reasons than any other people on the planet. And it became quickly apparent, this was all by, I should say, it was all shown first by a historian, a wonderful historian named Philip Curtin. And what it became clear was, it was if you were a plantation owner in Virginia or Carolina or Brazil or Haiti, what you wanted was labor. And if you brought over indentured servants from Europe, they would be very likely to die. Whereas if you brought over Africans, they would be much more likely to survive. And even though Africans were poor workers because they were slaves and they hated you, it's much better to have a poor worker that hated you than a dead worker.
But even among those African slave colonies, it's not quite the story that we have typically been given to understand. Tell folks a little bit about the rise of the maroon colonies in Central America, Brazil, and the impact that they had on cultural development, please.
Yeah. Well, in the first couple centuries after Columbus, many more Africans came to the Americas than Europeans. In fact, as late as 1820, almost four times as many Africans has been brought over to the Americas as Europeans. And consequently, they're the majority population in much of the Americas. less so in our country, but even in places like South Carolina and Florida, they were by far the majority population. And as one could imagine, it was difficult for Europeans to control these large numbers of people, particularly in tropical places where they were more familiar with that kind of environment than Europeans. If you took a European to Brazil, all those palm trees and, you know, wet forest-type vegetation was unnerving, difficult to deal with, whereas to somebody from, you know, Central Africa, that was the kind of place where they'd grown up. And so in those places, they escaped in huge numbers. Nobody really knows how many, but they went into the interior and established these mixed communities with native people who themselves were, you know, fleeing European slavery. And they're called Maroon Societies. They have a whole bunch of different names. Maroon Societies is the most common in English. And the term comes sort of tortuously from a Taino word meaning the flight of an arrow, you know, kind of a freedom image of freedom. And there are about 10,000 of these communities in Brazil alone, the most famous of which was called Palmares and is now a national park in Brazil. And there was a kingdom that endured for nearly a century and really threatened to unseat the entire colonial enterprise. And in a way, the revolution in Haiti, the revolution that was the first full-scale slave rebellion, was a Maroon rebellion.
And in fact, the fledgling United States government did everything it could to suppress that, did it not?
Yes. Our role in the Haitian revolution isn't one of the brightest moments in American history. The slaves rebelled, kicked out the French who were ruling the place, and then the United States and all the other slave-owning nations put a tremendous crippling blockade on Haiti that lasted for decades and essentially prevented anything from entering the country and doomed it economically.
One of the things that just had one of those lightning bolt moments for me in reading your book, Mr. Mann, is the statement that you make rather plainly that the culture of the Americas is not, in fact, a European culture. It is a black African culture, is it not?
Well, what I'm trying to say by that is, again, you know, if you're looking at this you know, scientifically, what you have to say is if almost four times as many Africans come to the Americas in the first three centuries, you know, after Columbus, what are those people doing? Those are the people who are building the roads. Those are the people who are building the buildings, farming the fields, you know, taking boats around the rivers. They're even, a large percentage of the crews on slave ships. And so from that perspective, what you're seeing after Columbus is less meeting, you know, Europe coming to a nearly empty continent, but a meeting of Africa and native people in the Americas with Europeans playing a demographically peripheral role.
And right down to the language, you know, this broadcast is originating in West Virginia, and I was born and raised in Alabama, and we think of the Southern accent, and we think about Miss Scarlet waiting for the, getting ready to go to the barbecue at 12 Oaks or whatever. Even the language was shaped by the culture that was compelled in this direction, was it not?
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that's kind of curious about, to me, about American education is that, you know, all kids now are, you know, of course taught that slavery was bad, and, you know, which it was. But, you know, I find when I talk to students, and in fact to most people my own age, we know it was bad. We don't know anything about it. We don't know why it occurred or what impact it had. And, you know, in part, my book is an argument that all of these things, you know, were profound, both the, you know, the part it played, the impact at hand, and they can be tied to this idea of this ecological convulsion. Because without malaria and yellow fever, it's difficult to understand how we would have had the kind of large-scale slave societies that we did, you know, in places like the Carolinas and the Caribbean and Brazil.
Let's back up a minute to, if you don't mind, to a little bit earlier time we talked about the agriculture. The myth that you put to rest, in my mind, at least, in 1491, this idea of a vast and open continent merely waiting to embrace the Europeans who came here. Can you talk a little bit about that, please?
Yeah. History books that, you know, we, that, you know, when I went to school, I'm, you know, in my 50s now, but I think the same thing is still pretty much the case. You know, harken back to the early parts of the 20th century when, in fact, due to disease and mistreatment, there were very few Native people. And they picked up on an image that came from the 19th century of the Great Forest. And, you know, people like Thoreau, you know, writing about the huge American forest. And it's only been in recent decades that we've learned that that kind of vast wilderness was, in fact, a recent phenomenon. And it was caused because the original inhabitants of this place, the people who were constantly, you know, burning areas to keep them clear for agriculture and cutting down trees and doing all the kinds of things that you do when you're, you know, a large-scale society, because they all died, the country reforested in the 17th century. And so by the time that my ancestors came here, you know, in 1807, they saw a huge forest, and they assumed that that was the way the landscape always had been. But in fact, it was a recent creation. And so when you talk to Native people, they have a very different feeling about wilderness than, you know, some people who are conservationists. For them, it's less of a wilderness than a cemetery.
Well, indeed. And in fact, in 1493, you document a portion of the life of a woman whose name, I believe, is Rosa in Brazil, whose life story has been one of being constantly run off her land. But if you look, and there's a magnificent photograph that you have kindly labeled with various plant names, there's a resemblance even in her 20th century agriculture to the agriculture of pre-Columbian societies generally in the Americas, in that what looked like jungle wilderness to the Europeans arriving was actually very carefully managed agronomy, was it not?
Yes. So there's two things that are, you're absolutely right. And there's two things that are going on. In areas where people die, there is a reforestation, and the land is not empty, but emptied, if you follow. So,
yes.
But then, where Native people live, what you have is a kind of agriculture that's very unfamiliar to people in Europe and Asia. It's called polyculture. And that's where you're growing multiple crops at the same time. And in, you know, it ranges up from, you know, half a dozen to as many as 20 crops might be in a single small patch. And then multiple, what they call semi-domesticates, in managed areas around it. And the result is something that looks completely unlike a European farm. And to European eyes, it looks just like a mess. It's like, what are these people doing? And as a result, when they would come in contact with these areas, they wouldn't recognize them even as farms. And this is especially true in places like the Amazon, where you have a very thin soils. And so as you know, ecologists are constantly telling you, you can't cut down the trees and plant, you know, wheat or something like that, you know, an annual crop, because you expose the soil to the punishingly heavy rain and the intense sun, and you wash away the nutrients and you turn the rest into something resembling brick, and you wreck the forest. So what Native people did is they would clear the forest bit by bit, and they would plant annual crops, mainly tubers, like manioc or cassava. But then the main thing was that what they did was called managing the succession. They would let the forest fill in the cleared areas, but with useful species. And there's a wonderful botanist named Charles Clement who has worked for many, many years in Manaus, which is the largest city in the Amazon. And he's documented, I believe, 168 tree crops that are grown, that have been grown at various points in the Amazon. And so when you see these managed forests with dozens of different useful tree species, you know, what the point of my picture, which you kindly described, is that to somebody like me who's unfamiliar with it, it looks just like a forest, right?
It looks like something that needs a weed eater.
Yeah. But to Donna Rosaria, who has planted and tended every single one of those trees, this is, you know, a flourishing farm. It's just something totally different than Europeans were used to seeing.
And one of those aha moments that I had way back with 1491, and you mentioned it again in 1493, is the principle, and it's an example of this, of planting one's beans along with one's corn. And from the time that I was a little boy and we would raise a little garden in the backyard, my West Virginian Appalachian mother, when we would plant a couple of rows of corn, in would go a couple of beans. With every kernel of corn, And right. As a child, I said, well, you know, why that? She says, well, all these other people are planting their beans separately, and they're going to have to work their butts off putting up string and putting up poles and letting the beans climb the poles. She said, why let the beans climb the poles when you can let the beans climb the corn? And so I'm reading in your books, and just had this sort of moment of intense connection with, you know, for all, you know, considering maize agriculture in the Americas, with about 10,000 years of just plain common sense. And that's what a lot of that pre-Columbian agriculture was, wasn't it?
I think, yeah, it was more than common sense. I mean, you're right, there is things like this which are common sense, but it was really a very clever kind of way to, you know, it's a completely different way of thinking about agriculture. What it is much, you know, Native American agriculture, much Indian agriculture, is really about creating artificial ecosystems that mimic natural ecosystems, that have something of the complexity of natural ecosystems. And so, therefore, you would have, it would often be based on what they call the three sisters, which are, you know, the corn goes up, there's beans around it, they twine up the corn, and then in the land around the bottom, you plant squash, which spreads out over the ground.
Exactly.
And holds back weeds. And so you're getting an extraordinary amount of production out of relatively small parcels of land. Now, it's more difficult to mechanize this kind of thing. And so there's a reason why, you know, farmers in the Midwest aren't doing it, because it's so much simpler to just take something completely flat and just, you know, cut it all down. But this is a way of agriculture that the agronomists say has a lot to teach us, and maybe now with, you know, sort of more knowledge and better technology, we might be able to take some of those lessons and apply them to the future.
And the other part of this is that you mentioned Donna Rosario's farm in the Amazon. Part of the vast wilderness myth was also that the Amazon was kind of this wet, squishy, prone to flooding, good for nothing, nowhere, that could never have supported any sort of major cultural growth. By virtue of your review of the extant research and literature, you also exploded that by way of pointing out again managed soils. Can you talk about the potsherds in the soil a little bit?
Sure. You know, as we were talking about before, much of the Amazon, and in fact, many tropical areas in general, have really poor soils. And this is one of the main reasons that so many tropical countries are poor. It's just really hard to grow enough food in poor soil. Native people in the Amazon came up with a technology that, I should immediately say that this is all very recent finding in an active area of investigation. So what I'm trying to summarize is sort of the current state of knowledge of something that will, you know, as people grow to understand it more, will change in the next few years. But as we understand it now, these areas, which are called, in my bad Portuguese, Terra Preta dos Indios, Black Indian Earth, were created by Native people by putting huge amounts of charcoal into the soil. And the thinking now, or the reason for doing that, is that the soil as it presently is full of aluminum, which is kind of toxic, and so as a result it's very poor in the kind of microorganisms, you know, bacteria and fungi and so forth, that make soil rich, that make soil literally alive, good soil. And so by burying soil, charcoal in there, which is made by cutting down the trees and then burning them in low temperature fires, you create a kind of soil within the soil, a place for beneficial microorganisms to hang out. And recent studies from Cornell, which has a terrific soil science department, and also the University of Sao Paulo, which also has a good one, have indicated that the sort of microorganisms that are in this changed soil are completely different than the ones that are in, you know, the adjacent unchanged soil. And these areas that are planted, which are scattered all up and down the Amazon basin, are, you know, have good, long-lasting soils that can be planted for decades upon decades. And so what you're seeing here, then, is really a completely different version of how to, you know, work with the earth. You know, you reshape the soil, and then instead of planting annual crops, you plant trees. And so it's a completely artificial ecosystem, but it's so rich that many of the areas
so in the attempt to save them from human activity, it's actually a preservation of previous human activity.
Right. And there's a terrible irony in this, because it's not hard to find places that are regarded as exceptionally rich and beautiful and find that they have been tended in this way by the descendants of native people mixed in with these former escaped slaves, these maroon communities. And yet, when they're set up as parks, these people are regarded as squatters and kicked out.
And that has caused no end of grief among other places, principally in Brazil. Is that right?
Right, but it's throughout lowland South America, because you can find the same thing happening in Paraguay. You can find it happening in Peru, in Colombia, in Bolivia. It's been very, very difficult for scientists, governments, conservationists alike to realize that there are people here who have a long history of a useful and good relationships with the forest.
And not just minuscule or microscopic isolated bands or tribes either, is it, Mr. Mann? It's a matter of
substantial populations.
The hundreds of thousands, right?
Well, in total, really nobody knows, but there are, it's widely believed that there are millions of people in the Amazon. And the kinds of signs that show this are in the Western Amazon, for example, in the Brazilian state of Acre, which is spelled A-C-R-E and looks like acre, and it's the westernmost state in Brazil, bang up against Peru, there's been a lot of illegal clearing for ranching and the sort of thing that environmentalists rightly decry. But one of the reasons it's bad is not because this land was never cleared before, because when they peel back the forest for these ranches, what they find are huge geometrical shapes cut into the earth, squares and circles and rectangles and so forth, hundreds of them stretching across an area as all the way going down into the